So the chocolates are.
We can bring them around.
So we get leftovers. It's okay. That's fair.
Call the meeting to order. Leon. I will take the roll. Commissioner Studley.
Here.
Commissioner Liu.
Here.
Commissioner Han.
Here.
Given that Commissioner Ward is has resigned his position, we are. This is it. Public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda that are within the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission. And before we begin, happy holidays to all of you and all those who have come. We've got some complimentary chocolates for all of those who wish to speak or not speak. You don't have to speak to get a chocolate, so feel free to jump up and grab them. Please, sir.
Good afternoon, Commissioner Hurd. Thank you for the holiday. Good wishes, the same to the commission. I would like the commission secretary to pass these six copies around, one for each member and one for Mr. St. Croix. On August 15th, the SOTF forwarded two of my complaints, which you are being handed now, numbers 11013 and 11014. They were forwarded to the Ethics Commission for enforcement. Case number 1113 found willful failure and official misconduct against Mr. St. Croix, your executive director, in the controller's office, Tanya Lettiju, manager of the city controller's whistleblower program. Case number 11014 also found willful failure and official misconduct against Mr. St. Croix. Now, 4 months later, I have not heard one word from Mr. St. Croix. And as I asked and noted in your minutes of your last meeting, when are my two complaints going to be scheduled for an open public hearing before this body? I know it's going to be difficult for you because Mr. St. Croix will have to find some way to recuse himself from this matter. The third enclosure in the package just handed to you is what is known as the Kerr and Wagstaff attorney's law letter dated December 2nd. You will note that many of his legal citations in his footnotes mirror exactly the citations I raised before the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force before they ruled in my favor. The section of the city charter, I believe it's 63-69913, that you in this commission, Mr. St. Croix, so vehemently cling to, is proven in the Kerr and Wagstaff letter to have no effect. It doesn't provide you with an exemption. And due to that fact, I'm sure when you hear my referral for enforcement, you'll see Michael Eng at Kerr and Wagstaff is correct. He also provides you many examples in which the citations that you rely on for state law are also moot because they don't provide you with any exemptions to withhold records. I recommend that this body convene a meeting and invite Mr. Eng, Mr. Terry Frankie from Calaware, and others to discuss the continuing neglect of this commission to take up SOTF referrals in a timely manner and to hold public hearings on them without re-adjudicating what the SOTF has already ruled on. I would like to look forward to having my hearing scheduled as an open public hearing before this body on one of your next meetings. 4 months is too long. You've heard this over and over during public testimony. Justice delayed is justice denied. 4 months is a little excessive not to have even gotten so much as a courtesy acknowledgement that you've received the referral for enforcement from the SOTF. Thank you.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Dr. Derek Kerr. After 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital, I became a whistleblower, and then I was laid off. Surveys by the auditing firm PricewaterhouseCoopers and by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners found that the majority of corporate fraud is exposed by whistleblowers. Similarly, the Justice Department Civil Fraud Division found that the majority of government fraud is exposed by whistleblowers. But in San Francisco, our whistleblower program treats whistleblower complaints as if they were threats. The National Whistleblower Center has documented over the past 20 years that retaliation against whistleblowers is common. But in San Francisco, our Ethics Commission would have us believe that whistleblower retaliation never happens. You have not tracked whistleblower retaliation complaints. You have not substantiated any retaliation complaint, and you have dismissed 100% of whistleblower retaliation complaints. This resembles your track record of dismissing every Sunshine violation, every referral from the Sunshine Task Force over the past 6 years, except for one case 2 months ago that lowered your dismissal rate from 100% down to 95%. So please consider an audit to answer two questions. Number one, how are whistleblower retaliation complaints investigated? And number two, why are they all dismissed? Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Dr. Maria Rivero. I worked at Laguna Honda for 22 years. Before I became a whistleblower, I was harassed by the Laguna Honda administration and subsequently lost my job, forced to resign. With the dismissal of our two whistleblower retaliation complaints, the Ethics Commission has upheld their unblemished 10-plus year record of never substantiating a whistleblower retaliation complaint during the tenure of Mr. John St. Croix as your director. This sends a loud and clear message to whistleblowers that if they suffer retaliation, there's no recourse within the city, and the only recourse is costly court proceedings. Of note also is that when our conflict of interest complaint regarding Dr. Mitchell Katz, the former health director's work as a paid consultant for a DPH, a company that was consulting for the DPH simultaneously, Dr. Katz was allowed to attend the closed session of your hearing last time. I took note of the fact that your investigator, Mr. Chatfield, greeted Dr. Katz with a warm smile and a hearty handshake. And he was allowed to stay during your closed session discussion. That's in marked contrast to the way that we were treated. We were repeatedly told by Investigator Chatfield that we were not invited to attend the closed session. And as we stepped out of the room, we had the door of this conference room closed tightly in our faces by Mr. Chatfield. What type of conclusion can be drawn from these actions? I will leave that to you. Thank you very much.
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. I would appreciate it if your secretary could let me know when I have 1 minute remaining. Why is the Ethics Commission so determined to retain their ability to censor public comments? that they would want to do so is evidenced by the 143-page response to a complaint filed with the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. This response consists of an 8-page letter and 135 pages of documentation, of supporting documentation, and has taken an extraordinary waste of city resources to compile. All of this effort maintains the Ethics Commission's ability to keep a speaker summary of their comments out of the minutes and allows the Commission's staff the to replace it with their representation, or I might say misrepresentation, of what the speaker said. It allows the marginalization and or silencing of free speech. It ensures that a member of the public with a dissenting opinion will be denied the right to have that opinion actually make it into the official public record. In essence, it allows a governmental body, this Ethics Commission, to suppress public comment. Censorship is the suppression of speech or other public communication which may be considered objectionable, harmful, sensitive, or inconvenient to the general body of people as determined by a government media outlet or other controlling body. You are the controlling body. And what you do is instead of including my 150-word summary of my own statement, you keep it at the end where people are less likely to read it and more likely to misunderstand it because it's taken out of context. And what you do also, and that is what makes it censorship, is put your interpretation of what I said into the actual minutes at the place where the comments occurred. And it is a very convenient way to keep a dissenting opinion out of the minutes, which is the official public record. And anybody who wants to put forward this argument that attaching them at the end is exactly the same as putting them in place has to be loonier or dumber than a box of rocks, because it's put there for a very purpose, and that is to marginalize it, to minimize it, and if possible, exclude it. I mean, the reality is these are dissenting opinions, and the Brown Act says to keep dissenting opinion out of the record, you have to show a compelling state interest. And no one, including the city attorney's office, has shown a compelling state interest. All they say is, this is what we can do, even though it's in direct contradiction of the law. And as I've noted on the top of my statement to be included in here, there are now two task force signings, decisions, that say in the minutes means in the body of the minutes.
The next item on the agenda is consideration of proposed amendments to the Statement of Incompatible Activities for the Department of Human Resources. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this item?
The Department of Human Resources is seeking to change some of the language in their Statement of Incompatible Activities to more closely align with their policies on confidentiality. I think the memo is self-explanatory. They've done their due diligence in terms of meet and confer with the unions. And Jennifer Johnston from the department is here. Perhaps she could just explain a little bit of background on this.
Good evening, commissioners. Jennifer Johnston on behalf of the Department of Human Resources. As staff indicated, it's our desire to amend the SIA as it currently exists, primarily to clarify for employees that examination materials remain confidential even after the examination itself has been administered, that employees may distribute or utilize proprietary materials as long as they're authorized to do so by the department, that officers and employees may not utilize or access confidential information for any unauthorized purpose, not just in the event that there's some sort of remuneration or benefit to them, and that DHR employees may not distribute DHR publications, mailing lists, or examination materials for any purpose unless they're specifically authorized to do so, and not just because, again, it would result in some sort of benefit or remuneration to them. The changes that we are proposing are consistent with DHR policy on confidentiality of information, as well as the civil service rules and public records laws, providing that such documents are exempted from disclosure based on their confidentiality. And as Mr. St. Croix indicated, we did meet and confer with our labor unions. They stated no objection other than just the request that we make sure to provide some training on employees when we roll this out, if the commission should adopt or approve of the changes. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Liu?
Hi, Ms. Johnson. Thank you. I'm on board with the overall concept. I just was curious about how or what sort of prompted it, because as I read the SIA, it's to address outside activity. Mm-hmm. And then when I read the provisions, it seems to be more about carrying out one's job duties to not disseminate information that they shouldn't be disseminating.
Why we expanded it?
Right. Is there some kind of a crossover that has been happening, that people are doing things outside of their job that they shouldn't be doing? Like, to me, it was there was just a little bit of disconnect there, because normally I see these sorts of policies within mm-hmm. an employment, like this is what you need to do in your job and not do in your job, as opposed to something that's outside, like an outside activity that's incompatible with your job.
My understanding, well, it's in the course of their employment that they'd be, you know, violating the policy.
Right.
But you're asking, you know, my understanding of the SIA was not that it was limited to activities that you undertake that are outside of the department, but that it could be in the course of your duties or that it related to your employment. So what precipitated some of these changes was that we had a few employees who were unclear as to the policy. One of them disclosed to a potential candidate, examination materials that had been, you know, administered several years ago, but you know, that obviously was providing that candidate a benefit or some sort of advantage over other candidates. So, and there were other kind of similar little small guffaws along those lines. So that's why we implemented the confidentiality policy and sought to kind of tighten up the provisions in the SIA.
So, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the commissioners? Seem pretty straightforward to me as well. Is there a motion with respect to this agenda item? Is there a second?
I second.
Public comment?
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director, San Francisco Open Government. It's not hard to deduce the reasons for the requested changes in the statement of incompatible activities. Some person or persons in the Department of Human Resources have compromised the examination process. They have provided others with information regarding the content of exams and or the examination process itself. At best, they may have provided persons with help that will give them an advantage over others taking the same exam. At worst, they have actually sold such information or used it to make money or allow others to make money. We will probably never know the extent to which the examination process was compromised or whether any action was taken regarding people involved. We will probably never know whether this is a case of the closing the barn door after the livestock has escaped. So effectively, this is a matter being dealt with out of sight of the public. Now, I read this. I was on the staff of the Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet in Honolulu for 3 years. Following by that, I taught for 14 years for the University of Hawaii. And following that, I taught for another 3 years for a large insurance company, where one of my responsibilities was to teach people how to effectively take and pass examinations in the real estate area, in the insurance areas. One of the things I know, it is possible to teach the test. And if this is simply a case where that's what they're trying to prevent, it's one, but I don't really believe that they're being very honest or open about the reasons they're making these changes. I would submit that somebody has already compromised this, and now they are trying to deal with it going forward. And while that may be a good thing, leaving out all the reasons and simply portraying this as it was does is this, we just want to make changes to make things better, I think is blatantly dishonest. And it really does raise the question as to whether or not these exams and the process have been compromised. The state of Hawaii used to give out old examinations so that you could formulate example tests for students taking training on the types of questions, because knowing the information is one thing, but understanding the questions and being able to deal with them effectively is something completely different. This restriction seems to place, say, basically nobody can give any information, any form whatsoever, whether it's old information that's no longer used or anything else, and I think puts an unconscionable restriction on certain people because they won't be given the advantage of getting some help on how to take and pass these examinations. And I'm not trying to say teach the exam. I'm simply saying for a person to go and take an exam which they have never seen, one of the hardest things they have to deal with is how to take the exam effectively so that they don't use up all of their time without getting all of the questions answered. And as a result, many people will fail, not because of a lack of knowledge, but because of a lack of experience. Others who have been through the exam process multiple times will get that help, and in particular, what the federal government calls it, is pre-selection, where I am a supervisor. In fact, I am your supervisor, and because I have already decided I want you to fill a position I have open, I will sit down with you and help you on the exam, something which the other candidates never receive.
Good evening, David Pilpel. First, let me start out on page 4 of the staff memo, the section DHR met and conferred with its unions. There's reference at the end of the third line there, see attached notice sent to the unions from Jennifer Johnston. That was actually not attached to the calendar item. I'm told that it does exist, and I look forward to seeing it. I'm not sure that it's material to the discussion tonight. Moving on to Commissioner Liu's comment, I take that in an interesting fashion. I'm looking in particular on page 2 of 7 of the attached SIA, section 3A1, activities that conflict with official duties, the second and third sentences there, which I think are the heart of the restriction, appear, following Commissioner Liu's discussion, to not be consistent with what follows, that outside activities conflict with official duties when the ability of the officer or employee to perform their duties is materially impaired. These restrictions don't seem to materially impair the ability of that individual employee to perform their work. It materially impairs the ability of the city or the department to carry out its duties and functions. So it's a different concept. It's a related concept, but it's not the same as what is suggested in 3A1. Moving on, I have a couple of minor issues with the language, starting with A. I would write it as discuss any examination content or any or other confidential information regarding an examination, and then keeping it the way it is, or actually, unless authorized to do so by the director or his or her designee, which is consistent with other language and other SIAs. Again, in the second example, unless expressly authorized to do so by the director or his or her designee. In B, I guess I'm good with for any unauthorized purpose. In the example, again, for any purpose not authorized by the director or his or her designee, it's not clear to me otherwise how something is authorized by the department. And again, in the second example, regarding any city employee for any purpose not authorized by the director or his or her designee. Moving on to the top of page 3, in D, I don't understand why an employee would be prohibited from distributing department publications in general if they are public records. So I would add something to the effect that except as necessary to carry out his or her official duties, comma, no officer or employee may distribute department publications, mailing lists, or examination materials unless authorized to do so by the director or his or her designee. Those would be my rather technical edits.
So, Commissioner Liu, did you have anything further in response to Mr. Pilpel's?
Well, after hearing what Ms. Johnston said, I still have just a slight disconnect that this isn't exactly, it's not really an outside activity, so I don't know if it belongs here, but I also have no problem with tightening up and making sure that employees are following the confidentiality policy. And if it's in the personnel policy, I suppose this is just further strengthening it. I could go either way. I mean, I think it technically doesn't quite fit with the way this is worded. As Mr. Pilpel was saying, it's really the intro paragraph there is talking about outside activities that conflict. And so to go on to discuss the procedures about disseminating information that I think is really about information related to their job and work and things they're not supposed to do, I could kind of see it seems a little borderline to me. It was just a little bit of a disconnect, but I'm fine with if the department wants to tighten it up and ensure that employees fully understand that it's incompatible, whether it's, you know, outside the job, their job, or within their job, that's in the course of their duties. I'm fine with that too.
Ms. Johnson, did you want to respond?
Sorry, pardon me, yes. If I could just clarify also, this is existing language, and so, if you're reading the language, it looks like, oh, I can do this unless it's for some sort of, so I see your point. It's just the way the language is now, it's not consistent with our other policies. So that's what really we're intending to do here is just make sure that it doesn't allow for huge loopholes that people aren't clear on. So that's just the purpose for the revisions.
Right. And Ms. Johnston, what do you think of the suggestion that was made by Mr. Pilpel about subsection D, where it says no officer or employee may distribute materials, that it's a little bit broad?
I think that's fine to say unless as otherwise required to adhere to public records laws I don't have that much of an issue with the proposed changes, although they are, you know, semantical or so. But I think it's fine. I really don't have an issue with it. Again, we're just seeking clarity here and to close some loopholes that people may perceive to exist.
Right. Okay. I see. So, I understand.
So I defer to, you know, they're non-substantive. I've already, you know, the unions are fine with this. So whatever the commission wants to do is fine with me.
Ms. Johnson, and were you the one that personally met and conferred with the?
I did.
Okay.
Yes.
Procedurally, can we make? I mean, if they've come up with this language, and I can see the merits of some of Mr. Pilpel's suggestions about specific language, but if this has been approved, it's either we approve this or they have to go back? Is that sort of where we're at?
Yeah. If you make changes, even though Mr. Pilpel's changes are pretty minor, the DHR would have to notice the unions again. That may just mean putting it off for one meeting.
Right.
That's how it works.
Right.
Could we approve it such that if they're okay with it, it doesn't have to come back to us on the agenda? If that's not comfortable, that's fine. No problem.
I mean, you know, to me, I think you can always, people can always suggest things, you can always improve things. Maybe Mr. Pilpel's suggestions are fine, but I didn't find this language to be unclear. So I would still be in favor of approving it. Was there any other public comment on this matter? Okay, so we have made the motion. Do we redo that?
No.
And seconded it. So let's call a vote. All in favor of approving the SIA change?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion passes. Next item on the agenda is consideration of possible amendments to CFRO.
Okay. So what we have done is put together a framework of proposals of what direction we need to go in to actually draft the legislative language to make changes in the public finance program. I would like to mention at the outset that the public finance program as it exists works the way it was intended to. There's nothing wrong with it there. It's a good program. The staff has managed it well. It filled its intended purpose. It's really the Supreme Court decision that we've discussed in the past that's kind of thrown the wrench in the works, and that's why we're revisiting this. We're not sort of fixing a program that was broken, but somebody else sort of stopped it. So having said that, we're going to need to draft legislative language, but first we thought we would bring the major issues surrounding what we need to do to the commission based on what staff feels is necessary, and then based on some fairly productive interested persons meetings that we held, so that we can work with the city attorney's office to draft something to send over to the board. So moving along those, we have a couple of decisions to make just in terms of what it's going to look like when we're done. And the goals are to keep the program viable, but to keep it attractive to candidates at the same time. So looking at the current program and seeing what needs to be done, we're going to go through several recommendations where the commission needs to make policy decisions of which direction we'll continue to head with this. So starting at decision point one, we're looking at the overall structure of the financing involved, and we need the commission to examine this from a policy point of view and look at what the threshold should be. The decision points in one and two sort of dovetail with decision point six, and that is we know we're not going to be giving extra public funds to candidates who have maxed out of public funds in the program. That's very specifically what the Supreme Court said we can't do. But the other decision is, do we put a hard cap in that once you sign up and get money, you cannot pass that cap, or do we make that adjustable? So decision point six should sort of be on your mind when you're looking at one and especially two, where we're going to go with that. Particularly if we need a hard cap, you need the amount of funds available per candidate to be attractive enough to make people believe the program will work for them. So decision point one has to deal with the qualifying threshold. And some of the input we got at the interested persons meetings were that perhaps it's not tough enough for people to get funds and that you should work a little harder to prove viability. This is also a soft fix to what we call the zombie candidate program. And the zombie candidate thing, we do not know if it's a problem or not, because it seemed to be an anomaly in this particular mayoral campaign. It hasn't come up before in supervisorial races. We'll address that overall issue later. But by making it slightly more difficult in supervisorial races and then later on in the mayoral race, candidates will have to do just a little bit more heavy lifting up front in order to access the funds available from the public.
Commissioners, comments? On this particular agenda item, I would suggest we take public comment first and then convene our discussion. So let's take public comment and decision point 1A and 1B.
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director, San Francisco Open Government. The one change in this that I very clearly object to is raising the threshold from $5,000 to $10,000. And I think it's rather bizarre to try to refer to some candidates as zombie candidates. I work on the understanding that people get into public get into the public process because they intend to do something which they feel needs to be done for the public. And to set a threshold of $5,000 is actually really kind of limiting to a lot of the candidates who would get in because they have issues which they feel they need to be, that need to be addressed, and yet they have to raise $5,000 from 75 different people just to get any money at all to participate. very frankly, $1 for $1 is what the other candidates get. It's just that they don't have to worry because they can raise 20 or 30 or 40,000. They know they're going to get that first 5,000. It's only the candidates who don't have somebody backing them who can give them a lot of money who are completely eliminated from the private from the public funding process. And it basically takes candidates who may have very, very viable ideas on things that need to happen in the city that are disadvantaged because they have to spend much of their time going out and try to get 75 people to donate so much money that they get a total of 5,000. And that is not a disadvantage that any of the other any other participants in the electoral process in the city have to meet. I mean, we just saw this last one where every 5 minutes we were seeing a declaration from here saying Mayor Lee had raised his threshold, so everybody else had to raise their threshold, and everybody else was allowed to get more and more money. And if that's what this is simply if you have more money, you can buy an office, I don't think anything shows that more clearly than telling someone who can only raise $3,000 or $4,000 that their efforts were not appreciated. And that basically because they couldn't raise that 5,000, which I'll be honest with you, I think that is something that the other candidates, especially the well-funded ones, like to see because it limits the participation of the average candidate in the electoral process and it limits their ability to actively participate in the electoral process. So raising it to 10,000 would eliminate more people. You know it would. Now from going to 5,000 from 75, you want to go to 10,000 from 100 people. That means they'd have to get at least 100 people to contribute $100 each. Not an easy thing to do, especially in these times. And I think it's really egregious to limit people's participation in the electoral process by making that change.
Fighting about the privilege of addressing you. David Pilpel, a number of these issues are connected, so let me just make a couple of quick introductory remarks and then address decision point one, A and B. The decision that the commission made at its last or second to last meeting to eliminate the aggregate limit so that anyone can contribute up to $500 per candidate, period, is, in my judgment, a significant change in the overall rules and makes it to a great extent easier to fundraise either within a district or citywide. And I'm bearing that very much in mind as I look at the numbers and the number of contributors and how that all plays out. So absent that change in rules, yes, it would be a lot harder to raise these sums, particularly at a higher threshold. With that change, it makes it easier, and I think we should bear that in mind going forward, and I am assuming that at least that provision of law makes it through the process and that that informs the continuing debate here. On 1A and B, I do think that 10,000 is a reasonable place to increase the threshold to. I don't think it restricts the number of candidates per se. It only restricts the number of candidates or makes it more difficult for candidates to participate in the public finance program. They choose to run for office, they choose to run for office. Just because you run for office does not mean that you're entitled to participate in the public finance program, and that should be clear. I'm not sure that we're well served. We're well served by having a number of choices for office. I don't know that we're well served by having a large number of similarly qualified candidates running for office. That's a policy argument to have. Perhaps not here. I'd also note very significantly on the fourth line of the discussion in 1A, right now it's 75 contributors before the 70th day. It's actually not of the election, 70th day prior to election day. I think it's very important, and I want to emphasize this, to move that deadline from E-minus 70 to about E-minus 60. If someone gets in the race, files on the last day, which is E-minus 88, under the current scheme, they would only have 18 days to raise, in this case, $10,000 from at least 100 contributors in the mayor's contest, depends when we get to decision point eight. I think that that becomes a lot more difficult, and I think providing an additional 10 days to E-minus 60, which would essentially give people 28 days, just under a month, if they file on the last day, is reasonable given the other changes to the program requirements. So I would strongly encourage you to give staff direction, not just on the 10,000 and 100 contributors, but to move that last qualifying day from E-minus 70 to E-minus 60. As to decision point 1B, I definitely agree that at least 50% either of the contributors or of the funds should come from within district for Board of Supes contests. Thank you.
Stephen Hill. First of all, I wanted to thank the commission for taking this up, and particularly to the staff, Mabel Ng and John St. Croix, for having the interested person meetings. I think it was really helpful to have that interaction, and really felt that there was an openness there to hearing input from the public. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. I think that was an important part of this process. In terms of just these two items, I guess we're going to go through them a little bit at a time. I do think that this is appropriate to change from 5 to 10,000. I had reservations initially, as one of the people that drafted the original law back in 2000. You always are never quite sure with these numbers what's the right one, what's the sweet spot, and we've been using the same numbers for a number of years now, and I've gone around and asked a lot of people, both current office holders, former candidates, those who won, those who have lost, do you think if we went from 5 to 7,500 or 10,000, would that be prohibitive? And pretty much everybody thought that, if you're out there and you're a serious candidate, you should be able to raise 10,000. It shouldn't be that big of a problem for you. It raises an interesting question whether the public financing is there for someone who wants to raise issues or someone who's trying to win. Obviously someone who's trying to win is also trying to raise issues, but maybe some people just want to raise issues, and is that appropriate use of public money? I'm not sure it is. When you look at a race like District 10 in 2010, where we had 21 candidates, 10 of them had public financing, were there that many different constituencies in District 10 that needed to have that many candidates raising that many issues? I think you can make an argument that at a certain point, you reach a tipping point where the field sort of splits in a way that makes it harder for voters to actually hear a full airing of the issues and the debate of ideas that you want to see ideally in a campaign. So, again, we are now, 2011, trying to come up with the right number. I think 10,000 is something that is worth a try. We don't know whether it will actually work, but I think, based on what I'm hearing back and feedback from people, this is an okay number to give a try. In terms of the qualifying contributions, I've definitely heard feedback from people that if you were to try to require a certain amount of the money must come from certain districts, that they would not be in favor of that because some districts have more money than others. And so you would be, in a sense, penalizing those candidates who come from the poorer districts in San Francisco, District 10 being a classic example. So I like the idea of instead requiring that just a certain number of the donations themselves of whatever size, it could be $5, $10, okay, $10, must come from within the district, and that I think that is appropriate. So I think that's a good compromise that you have raised here. So I would support that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Comments from the commissioners on decision points 1A and 1B?
You have a couple of questions.
Commissioner Sudley?
Do we know what proportion of contributions have come from in-district or what the range is? I'm just trying to get a little purchase on whether 50% is a big change from current practice.
Well, it's a big change because we haven't had any district requirements before, only in-city requirements. But we haven't done an analysis of what percentage in each district has come in past races.
Right. So we don't know how much of a difference that would be or by particular districts. Did the staff talk about the idea of a Okay, so this is written as 50% of the contributors, not of the contribution.
Not of the contribution, right, for the same reasons that Mr. Hill stated that, right. You know.
I share, I think, the concern you're suggesting.
I like in general the idea of having people who are running in a district have enough grounding in the district to warrant being publicly supported to run in that district. I'm just trying to figure out what a reasonable expectation is that doesn't have unintended consequences and go the other direction of.
And my big concern with the percentage is I would rather see 50 people, because if you have a percentage, then if you raise the money from 1,000 people, you're creating this perverse incentive where you're not going to want more contributors because you need to hit a 50% threshold. So that
Even
is a change
point.
I would make.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. With respect to the amount, I think I hear the arguments on the other side, but to me, it makes sense to raise it for the reasons that were described by Mr. Pilpal and Mr. Hill. With respect to the 60th day, does that was there any discussion at the interested persons meeting about that, and does it? Are there any unintended consequences that the staff can see with moving that back?
Can I just add one brief thing on that?
Sure.
So the reason that I looked at that carefully over the last week or so, I was trying to analyze the contributions from November of 11 and project that back to other contests. If someone really did get in at the end, it would just make it very difficult within 18 days. I think the only practical implication is the date by which the commission establishes the PCADL, the per candidate available distribution limit, might have to be moved back a couple of days as well. But I think it really just allows the program to work better, to really just constrain it in that way.
I mean, that said, I hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, but that said, if someone is going to enter a race 70 days before or 88 days before and can't raise $10,000, during that time, their viability is.
I understand
the point, but if there are reasons why the staff has pushed it that far back, I don't want to unintentionally create a problem by changing it from 70 to 60.
It seems to me that the 70th day is also the last day for candidates to file. Isn't that correct?
No.
Is it?
The 88th day. I recall last time the commission and the board amended a number of provisions in the CFRO maybe 2 years ago. You created an appeal process for someone who didn't qualify for public funds at the outset. The executive director denies the application. They can ask for reconsideration. Then they get a hearing before the commission, and that's a process that takes about a month overall. And so it may be that one of the reasons for the 70th day is to allow time for that appeal process to happen, so that if in the end the commission says, yes, you are eligible for public funds, it's not the day after Election Day.
Hmm. So maybe something the staff can look at and see
if
they can balance those concerns. Just in general, I wanted to raise the issue. There are many of these decision points here. If we put forth a proposal to the board with all of these decision points, as a practical matter, it seems that the likelihood of all of those provisions being passed through in one piece may be difficult. And so I was wondering whether there was a mechanism for making these proposals, but making them such that the board could adopt some and reject others while still accepting the larger piece of legislation.
We've actually discussed putting them, when we put them together, to do it in a modular format so that you adopt, you know, one set of changes and then a few separate sets. And when we get to the actual dollar numbers, it may be that we want to adopt multiple versions so that the board can, you know, finish it. The commission will recommend what it thinks is best, but in terms of doing that, I think we've already kind of planned out.
Okay, because for example, to me, decision point 1A, that policy decision is more important than 1B, and I would hate for part of this to not get through because of our insistence on 1B, for example. At least in my view, that. So I don't know, is that sort of granularity in terms of the modules what you had?
Yeah,
envisioned?
I mean, I don't want to send over 20 proposals, even sure. if they're not competing, but we'll reduce it to, or increase it, I should say, to a number that's workable, but that can still be adopted separately and work without 100% of them.
Okay.
So, Mr. St. Croix, when you were talking about different models, do you mean like in the attached appendix, how you had laid out sort of the different proposals and that's what the board would see? More or less?
No, I mean, we'll just word them as individual proposals.
Okay.
So instead of one proposal with everything in it, we'll cut it up into smaller ones.
Okay.
Commissioner Studley, you had a comment?
I've been grappling with the question of whether $10,000 is a reasonable level, and I appreciate the contributions from the public both ways in the sense of the meetings. I think Mr. Hill's soundings are useful as well. I wondered if you considered, though, whether it would be manageable to do something that kept the 5,000 or a lower number if the candidate received a substantially larger number of, had contributions from a substantially larger number of people, or would it be just impossible to manage as a just record keeping, and I know that you're under a lot of time crunch when you do it. If, for example, it were $5,000 from 250 people or $10,000 from what would now be
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to get a sense of the viability of the candidacy in situations where interest in that candidacy going forward was there, but the contributors were small dollar contributors.
We hadn't thought of it in those terms. Something like that, I suppose, could be done, but that the administration of the program becomes exponentially more difficult. And
that's why I'm not suggesting a ratio that varies all along the way, but at least has only two tests. But you know, I understand that it could be a challenge, but, and maybe the candidate would have to tell you which one they were going after at a certain point or something.
Hmm.
But why would it be that much harder to administer? Because right now it's $5,000, and they could raise it from 250 people,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have to check that the same way you would if there was an option of. I mean, essentially, if you're looking at it from what we're doing now, it's arguably less work because you're raising the threshold for at least those who would choose the fewer contributor mechanism for getting to the threshold. I mean, assuming it was either or, you know, only two
it
possible.
Wasn't $7,500 at some other number.
Right.
I think that just does sound more difficult. I mean, I'm trying to get at the idea of a more of a showing of viability, mm-hmm. but trying to get away from doing it from just cash or increasing the number of people where the average gift has to be what it would under these scenarios. To do it by an expression of interest, allowing it to be for people whose resources are more limited. Perhaps I don't want to extend this unduly, but maybe the members who spoke on both sides, all three. Addressing some of the problem or making it too hard or not necessary.
And would that affect in your scenario the 50% showing or the 50, what did we decide?
50 contributor showing.
50 contributor showing.
I'd be inclined to keep it simple if we think that that's enough in district.
Mm-hmm.
Or I probably would try and, since I don't, I'm making do it, but the fewer things that vary, perhaps the easier.
Yeah.
That's my thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say that that is attractive because, also because I'm sure there is going to be substantial resistance to raising this threshold, and this threshold is a sensitive issue because of the concern for many grassroots candidates who are trying to get involved. But we have this competing concern of making sure that, as best we can, that public funds are used efficiently for viable candidates. So to me, it kind of sounds like an elegant solution. But if there are other members of the public who want to speak, let's put a one-minute limit on it, on this particular question. We'd appreciate it.
Just one piece of information that might be helpful. I think when it comes to the board, I don't think you're going to find any problem there in increasing it to 10,000. There was no resistance from any member of the board that I talked to everybody.
But by definition, board members are incumbents.
Yes.
And incumbents have a different set of, they now sit in a different seat. I'm not casting any aspersions. They just have interest then.
No, I realize. But in terms of getting 8 votes there, I don't think this is going to be a problem. And your proposal, I think, is workable. I think there is an issue of trying to not make things too complicated, but, you know, it might be something that's workable.
Commissioners, Ray Harris, Director, San Francisco Open Government. And I do agree that that would be a viable option because, unfortunately, the $10,000 limit would most affect the economically disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. If you have someone who lives in the Mission or the Bayview and they decide they want to get into the election to bring up particular issues for their area, then basically what you're saying is that unless you can raise $10,000, you can't do that. And the reality is we're not supposed to be picking winners and losers, as the Republicans like to say in Washington. We're supposed to be making it viable for all people who want to participate in the electoral process, especially those who want to represent interests of those who they feel need to be spoken for. And I think that that option would then allow a person in a poorer community to simply get a number of members of that community who could maybe only give $5 or $10 if they could give that and still be able to qualify for the funds, which would allow them to double the reach, their outreach to the voters of the city as far as reaching those and addressing those specific areas of concern.
As far as whether the number should be 200 or 250, I don't feel strongly. Mm-hmm.
David Pilpel again. I just wanted to direct the commission to the top of page 8 with the information about winning candidates in the past 2 cycles where there was no incumbent. The lowest spending candidate was apparently David Campos in D9 with $136,000. It just seems to me, and again, not picking losers and not trying to be too judgmental, if you haven't raised $10,000 by E-70 or E-60, then I'm not sure that you're really a serious candidate. Whether or not you can win or not is different, but I just don't think that you're a serious candidate for purpose of this thing, and so that's why I think 10,000 is defensible. I just don't think that you can run a viable winning campaign in the city for less than like 100,000 these days, probably 125 or 150, and I think that's just where it's going to. I don't want to increase the average expenses in a campaign, but I just want to recognize that it takes something to do it, and if you can't find 10,000 by E-70 or 60, you know, which leads me to the 10,000 number. Thanks.
Another problem is if different candidates qualify at different dollar levels, mm-hmm. what's the match? Do they get only equal to what they raised? Do they get the whole 10,000? And then the formulas would have to be different for every candidate. In addition to individual expenditure ceilings, whether there's a hard cap or a soft cap, the initial expenditure ceilings will be different.
I don't know that the initial expenditure ceiling would have to be different, but you're right that the first match would be different, certainly.
I'll just tell you my reaction. It may be a different enough scenario that it's not supportable or not supportable. And I am, maybe I'm dreaming, but the expenditures here probably assume a particular kind of expenditures for races. And as I try to transpose the kinds of grassroots activities that I know about done on issues that have admittedly at great, you know, human sacrifice, that are consultant-light, do their communication through increasing free electronic methodologies. I'm just trying to think about how we would keep the door open for somebody running a campaign of a different model that was people-driven and imaginative, and not close the door on that. And it may be that you have to have $10,000 X days out, or you can't even, you know, have a, you know, do you need a new telephone to be able to do whatever the most core, you know, ability to file and participate might be. But I'm trying to imagine that as things change in how people communicate or what mass movements are that are different from campaigns run in traditional ways, that there might be another model, and I don't want to close somebody out of being able to do that, who has numbers instead of, you know, headquarters run the way campaigns are usually run and the averages that we're looking at. Can those people win or not? I'm sort of interested in trying to see. And I have an answer that I don't intend at all to be flip. You know, you need to remind us of questions like how would we calculate all of those scenarios. In a way, if somebody had enough to meet the threshold to be able to demonstrate the kind of momentum or interest to get a chance to run, there is so much money moving in here, I would give them the I might not convince other people, I would let them have the $5,000 from the public side of the financing system to put them at 10. And thereafter, they live or die by what they raise and what match they would get. But partly to keep it easy for the staff, I would just say that if you can do it from 5,000 from a larger number of people, I would call it 10 and go from there, and then you're on your own.
So you would match 5,000 with 10,000?
I would let them, right. I would say that they have now demonstrated from the public scenario enough to have us equalize it at that point, and thereafter the formula remained the same. If they have people and not dollars, they get only what they qualify for in the match and see if they can do it with people.
I realize
this is a, you know, sort of a last minute suggestion, but it came to me as I was hearing the sort of balance back and forth. But I think this way might leave the staff not having to say, okay, we've got A candidates and B candidates. We've got this formula and that formula. Because I think during the season that you have to do this, that straightforwardness and simplicity really, really matter. Once somebody's in, I can't imagine asking the staff to keep a whole second set of formulae and books and levels and so forth. But of all the moving dollars in here in the system that we're providing, another $5,000 to people who qualified but not at that level seems smaller. I don't know whether people who got the 10 would think that they were being substantially disadvantaged if somebody's got 5 at that level. I don't live in the guts of it.
Commissioner Hahn, were you, was there something, did you want to say something?
Well, I do favor the $10,000 amount. And, you know, again, why do we have public financing? Theoretically, it is to level the playing field. It is not, however, I don't believe, to provide any Tom, Dick, or Harry a chance to have a soapbox so that they can present their ideas. People can present their ideas irrespective of campaigns or elections, and we don't need to fund that. People can find their own ways to get their ideas across. I think the public questions the whole idea of public financing, and I think that this last election showed that there were far too many candidates who had no possible chance of being elected, and it just serves to confuse the voting public when you have that many candidates. Now, I'm not against that. If there are 50 candidates, so be it. But I think they have to show that they are serious and capable of raising the kind of money that it takes to get elected in this city. It's, you know, the sad fact is that the real politic of elections requires a lot of money, you know, above and beyond any public financing. So I think that we need to make these changes so that the candidates that are running for office are truly viable and are very serious from day one, and not just there to get name recognition. I think there was a general feeling that a lot of people were running for office just to create some name recognition for the future. I'm not sure that that's our job and that or the job of public financing. It's to level the playing field for serious candidates. And that's my feeling about it.
I find that persuasive. I think that that coupled with the added complexity of having two tiers, at least my gut reaction to matching $5,000 raised with $10,000 of public financing initially when there are others who are going to qualify having raised the full $10,000 doesn't strike me as maybe the best policy. And so with that complexity added to Commissioner Hand's concerns and the concerns raised by many others, I think maybe we should just leave it at $10,000. Commissioner Liu, did you have?
Well, I thought Commissioner Studley made a pretty compelling argument for leaving the door open for truly grassroots candidates, just as a matter, as a threshold matter, certainly not if they don't, you know, after that, if they don't succeed and don't get a viable base, but perhaps leaving the door open and just making sure they have enough community support through the number of people. Who knows, if they get their foot in the door, maybe they'll get more momentum, maybe they will get, you just never know. And so I think with Commissioner Studley, why close the door on that possibility when we don't really know whether the 10,000 is the right number or the sweet spot? I mean, I understand from all the interested persons meetings that everyone was leaning towards the 10,000. I'm not against the 10,000, but I think Commissioner Studley raised a really good point about keeping at least some other option, and then once if that qualifying amount gets there with the additional number of contributors, that they can get their foot in the door and try to, you know, get the populace that they need.
And how would you propose having the match done?
I was assuming, actually, before Commissioner Studley made that suggestion, I was assuming we would have to do something like that. Just you know, give them, say that it's either this or that, and then you qualify for that initial match, so that we wouldn't have two tiers going.
Right. So you also would match the $5,000 with $10,000 in public funds.
Right. I think from the beginning when she proposed the two, I was thinking it was either or, and then they'd get that same initial match.
I mean, I suppose. What's that?
It's a challenge with 2-2.
It is. And we need. This is just a majority.
We need Charles. You know?
We need four votes.
You need four votes when you have an ordinance in front of you,
right?
In January, presumably.
Right. I see. Right.
Right now, you don't need a vote at all. Yeah, I think that a vote would be helpful for the staff.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no particular requirement.
You know, I would be interested in the staff playing it out considering it, certainly, given the feelings of the at least half of the commission at this point. with any idea that comes up, you know, the light bulb of genius that comes up on the spur of the moment, there can be unintended consequences. So perhaps we should direct the staff to consider it and figure out whether it would add. My biggest concern is with the additional burden caused by this, and particularly the added complexity. Certainly in addition to the viability issue, but what do my fellow commissioners think about that?
There was a lot that Commissioner Hand said that I found also very important. I agree with her completely that we want candidates who are truly running for office, not just saying I can speak free one way and with somebody else helping pay for it another way. I think that the question for me is, are there multiple ways to demonstrate that you're serious and there's enough interest to create that credibility? I don't disagree with the core philosophy that this is not for all comers and that there is some point that something that people need to demonstrate that there are people who want the chance to consider them for an office, not just.
And to that,
them out.
And
I'm just not sure, whether we would lose people who are serious. But I also admit, that there are a lot of fair questions about this. it is whether or not it's a good idea. It's hard to try and walk through a new idea in something as complicated as all of this. At the end, so
I think the commission has consensus that we should have some piece of legislation that has a $10,000 threshold for 100 with 100 contributors, and that at least 50 contributors should be from the district. But it sounds like there's also some interest, although not unanimous support for having 250. Contributions. If you had 250 contributions, you could qualify by raising $5,000. And so I would suggest that the staff look at that second possibility, but that the staff certainly and should come back with a recommendation, while also working towards the legislation of the $10,000 threshold with 100 contributors. Does that sound fair?
Take one brief comment.
Sure.
I think it would be helpful to look at how many contributions each candidate's got in the past, because it occurs to me that 250 is probably quite a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of the candidates may have only gotten about 250 in total. So you just want to make sure you're picking a number that's realistic.
That's why I said either 200 or some other.
Right. But I mean, but sort of to your other point, Commissioner Sedley, if you can raise $20 from 250 people, maybe you really are a viable candidate. I mean, the numbers don't suggest you would be probably given the cost, I do appreciate the concern that when you're looking down the road as to what an election may look like, the past is not always, indicative of what could happen. So, to me, if it was rare for candidates to raise contributions from 250 people, that would actually. Yeah, to me that would suggest that, wow, if you really can do that, then maybe you are viable despite the low dollar amount.
Can I ask a question of Mr. Sinclair? So on page 4, is still within that decision point 1A discussion, in the middle of that big paragraph it says in the November 2010 election, X amount in public funds was dispersed to 6 candidates who received 5% or fewer votes in the first round of voting. I was curious, do we know what was the jump after that, after the 5%, the percentages of the remaining what the remaining candidates received as first choice, first round voting?
We know what it is, but obviously we don't have the numbers with us.
Do you know if a huge jump, like it was?
I don't know.
Everybody, okay. I was just curious about that.
Okay. So we don't actually need to vote on any of these, right? Since this is
kind of need to know where your mind
is. Is that direct? Was that direction?
We're fine with one with 1A, and I think 1B, with the idea that it's 50 contributors, not 50%.
Right.
So I think we can move on to
decision point two.
And this essentially is asking for direction on what the overall maximum of public funds should be in supervisorial races. Currently, it's 89,000. Obviously, staff has recommended looking at 100, 125, and 150. Given what we do know and what we don't know about the future. We think that even if the $150,000 option is chosen, it doesn't mean everybody's going to get that much money. We do want to contain the overall expenditures of the program, and that sounds very generous, but it's not likely that lots and lots of candidates are going to max out. And then while you're making your decision on 2A, B, and C, if you look in the appendix, on pages 13 and 14, it shows several ways that those could actually play out, depending on the decisions you make in terms of the overall maximum caps.
Perhaps we should discuss decision point two with decision point three, because I think they sort of impact each other. I could imagine a situation where you would be less comfortable with increasing the total amount per candidate if the match was 1-4 versus if it was 1-2 after the initial match. It is also related to 5, that is true. But to try to keep it at or we could just take them one at a time. Did the commissioners have a strong view of? Let's just take them one at a time. Public comment, decision point two.
Yeah, I mean, the thing to realize about this and five as well is that this is kind of because we're losing the trigger. And so without that trigger, the thinking behind the whole public financing initially was we would cap the amount of spending and allow the amount of public money to be a certain amount, knowing that if privately financed candidates broke that cap, that the candidates would then be able to receive more money. So we tried to make the spending and everything as low as we possibly could, knowing there was an escalator, a trigger, in certain circumstances. But that trigger is now gone. So the question becomes, how do we make it still attractive enough for candidates to participate, but also fulfill some of the other original goals of keeping spending as low as possible? And again, we're sort of suggesting numbers, not knowing ultimately what will work best, but all you can do is give it your best shot. So. I think that the $150,000 mark is in terms of the amount of available public funds is right. Currently, it's $89,000. If you just went to $100,000, that's only $11,000 more than it is now for losing the trigger. If you go to $125,000, that's $36,000 more.
And Mr. Hill, when you're referring to losing the trigger, you're talking about the independent expenditure ceiling being raised and the matching funds for
it's not just independent expenditure, but even privately financed candidates outside of independent expenditures. If a privately financed candidate also broke the cap previously, regardless of what independent expenditures did, you were also eligible to receive more money. It was both independent expenditures and privately financed candidates. If either of them broke the spending cap, you were eligible to receive more money.
More public financing, right.
And so that's gone. And so we you know, what's going to be enough to allow them to run a competitive campaign to make them feel like if they get hit with a lot of independent expenditures or they bump into a competitor who's a privately financed candidate with extremely deep pockets, will they have enough money to compete? And so I think looking at it from that perspective, the $150,000, along with, I could go live with either of the expenditure ceilings proposed by staff, $250,000 or $300,000, and keeping in mind that not every candidate will reach that, but it's there available in case they need it, in case in a particular race that amount is needed. So that's where, you know, we're sort of trying to build in a trigger that's not a trigger, if you will, by making enough money available for them to run a competitive race.
Thank you.
David Pilpel, my thinking is similar to Mr. Hill's, but I actually land on $125,000. It just seems to me that, and I agree, $100,000 is too low, and that's where I started out in this discussion, although it is freezing in here, I agree.
Yeah, it is quite cold.
And it just seems to me that $150,000 is too high, and $125,000 is about it's $36,000 more, it's about a 40% increase. That seems like, if we're making modest changes to the program, that seems like a modest change to the program. 11,000 seems like it's not enough. You know, 150,000 seems like it's too high. 125 seems like it's about right, and it makes some of the other numbers work nicer. Ultimately, if this is what it comes down to, I could probably live with 150. I just think, again, that we're hopefully not going to get there in the next two cycles or the next 4 years, and I don't want to encourage people to fundraise and spend as much as possible. I want people to fundraise and spend what they need to communicate, and I think 125 does that. Thanks.
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. And I can't help but feeling we're getting into a case of penny wise and pound foolish. In the previous item, we were talking about people who raise between $5,000 and $10,000 and kind of labeling them as not viable candidates. And yet here we are talking about raising money for people who can probably raise as much money as they want to, if not just write a check out of their own account, and we're going to give them another $61,000. It seems kind of egregious to say, okay, well, we can't afford to have two or three candidates who raise $6,000 each and give them matching funds, but we can afford to give $60,000 more to people who have no problem raising money. And it isn't a question of vetting candidates. Candidates get vetted by the number of signatures it takes for them to get on the ballot. Once they're on the ballot, they're a viable candidate. Whether anybody else thinks they have enough money is a separate issue. If I get enough signatures from fellow citizens to get myself on the ballot, I am a viable candidate by definition. That's the law. And sitting here and having arguments that we need to give the people who can raise unlimited funds an extra $61,000 when we've just decided that the person who can only raise $6,000 or $7,000 doesn't qualify for anything really kind of throws the whole idea of participative democracy out the window. And again, I heard the comment that we're not here to decide who should or should not be a viable candidate. But in essence, if that's effectively what you're doing, maybe you're not here to do it, but if that's what you do, that's what you're doing. So I think, again, having these arguments side by side and looking at them as a whole and saying we can afford to give someone $61,000 more, each candidate $61,000 more for the top five or six or whatever number it is, but then we have to say, oh, well, if somebody raised only $7,000, we can't afford to match that. They're not really viable. Well, bottom line is, if I can raise $5,000 and I can get a matching $5,000, that may very well be the thing that makes me a viable candidate. It may be the very thing that I get out there when people start to listen to what I have to say. They go, you know, he's got some points. And maybe that's when the checks start flowing in, and that's when I can go out and actually do more of an effort. And at least it gives me a competitive a possibility of being competitive with all the folks that can raise unlimited funds. And like we're seeing now with people like Mitt Romney and Michael Bloomberg and whatever, that can simply go into their bank and write a check and simply say, I can win office because I can outspend all of you, and I don't need the damn public funds. So if you want to get public funds, well, good for you, but I'll beat you anyway.
Commissioner's comments on decision point two.
So I agree that we need to raise the cap because the trigger is now gone. Just from the figures that were on page five on the 2010 and 2008 election, it seems to me that 125 should be sufficient while still keeping the spirit of not encouraging more spending. So I think I'd be more comfortable with 125.
Ditto.
I agree on balance, but alternatively, to me, 150 is not a deal breaker, assuming that other things are there to prevent to help ensure efficient use of the funds. And the way that the staff has laid it out, what I think we can do here is do it in the alternative. Was that what you were? What the staff was asking for here, or were you hoping that we would come to an agreement on which one of these funding levels should be included? In other words, is it substantially more work to make it 125 or 150 than to make it?
Are you asking, would it be helpful to have a vote on each one so that you know the range and can think about it all, how it all hangs together at the end?
Yes. Yeah.
To put it this way, are any of these a deal breaker for anyone here?
That's another way to put it. Is 150 a deal breaker for any of the commissioners?
I would prefer, like Commissioner Liu, to be sensitive to the total cost, but no, it's not a deal breaker. I'd rather be a little behind than leading the average cost of the races. But I could live with it if there were a good reason or if we understood the supervisors to have a strong view.
Okay.
Commissioner Hann, any alternative view?
And one thing, from the board's perspective, the Supervisor Kim's proposal, and she's been kind of the champion of this on the board, was closer to the 150 figure. So just FYI.
Sure. Is that pretty clear?
Yep.
Okay, decision point three, changing the formula for matching public funds.
Public comment?
Do you want to say a couple sentences about this and we can take public comment?
Again, the feedback that we got was that the 1-4 match was, it's kind of the same argument as the other ones. Because it's overly generous, it's front-loading campaigns that are not going to maintain steam throughout the whole race.
Public comment?
I think there's general consensus with the 1-2 ratio. I just wanted to take a moment to look at the chart on the bottom of six, and I'm thinking about this a little more. I think we need to, assuming that we end up in something like this, I'm not sure that the non-matching amount should be 50 or some number like that. I think it should just have an overall expenditure ceiling, because I can see instances where somebody raises the 10 or the 10 plus 40 on the private side and makes the public match, but they don't get to the entire next 50, so they don't get to the full 100 of private potential matching because they've got either a lot of non-matchable contributions from in-city or friends and family from around the country, and I still want to allow that to be non-matching up to the IEC, but not within the above the line framework. Are we? We understand. Okay.
I think.
But yes, I'm with you on 1-2 or 2-1 or yes. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. No. I see your point. I guess I didn't take the chart to suggest otherwise, though.
Okay. I guess it's just a way to interpret a chart. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioners?
Okay.
Yes.
Any dissenting views to 2-1? Okay.
All right. And then decision point 4 again is delaying disbursement means that candidates will have had some time to demonstrate viability later on. The money will have more impact spent later on. And so this is part of, again, are there too many, is the program too accessible? This will make it a little bit less so, so that candidates have it, as I said, chance to establish viability.
So this is separate and apart from the redistricting issue that we had to push back the time.
Yeah, that's a one time only.
Okay.
Public comment on decision point 4.
Yeah, I think this is a good idea. The June date. There's kind of a companion to this that doesn't come under the purview of the Ethics Commission, but it's to change the qualifying deadline for candidates themselves to the same date, so that you would know who's in the race before you start spending money. And that proposal is going to come before the Board of Supervisors. So, you know, it makes sense. And also another consideration is that the for some of the people who are candidates or considering running, they start thinking like, should I run for assembly? Should I run for board? So to have this date be after the June primary for state races, because those candidates who want to run in the state races and say they lose, they still have time to file for the board and for other local races. And that's just a consideration, because some of the people on the board are thinking of these things, and you want to make sure that it doesn't become a deal killer for them. So, yeah, I think second Tuesday around there puts you after the state primary, and with the companion coming later of moving the qualifying deadline for candidates, I think this will be good public policy. It addresses the zombie candidate, as it's been called, issue, because that way at least candidates will know who's in the race. And I've asked a lot of people about this, including candidates that were in the mayor's race who maybe would be considered zombie candidates, and they seem to think this would have been a good idea. Thank you.
Interesting.
Go ahead.
David Pilpel again. I've thought a lot about these dates and how they work within the overall program scheme, and originally I was with early May. I've now thought about that some more, and what I would actually say is that the earliest that a candidate could submit paperwork to the commission would be mid-May. Like May 15th is a good, hard date for that. And the earliest that they could be certified and receive funds would be early June, assuming, again, that it's going to take the staff some time to process. I mean, you can't exactly turn in, you know, 250 contributions or even 100 with all the documentation and have that get turned around in 3 hours. Not going to happen. It's going to take a week or two, you know, 2.5 weeks, and then there'll be disputes back and forth a bit. This is how the program actually plays out. So I'm also thinking in terms of design that if it's really a six-month program, so if you have from early June is the earliest that you could get certified, and early December, like 30 days after the election, is the latest that you can get matched now, then you really have a six-month window. And you would have to qualify, again, if you move that back from E-70 to E-60, you have like the first 3 months from early June to early September to qualify, and then you can submit claims essentially from, again, mid-May, but effectively mid or early June to early December. So it's really a six-month program, and that seems to me to make sense to an election cycle. We don't want sort of permanent campaigns that everybody's fundraising all the time for whatever their next thing is, and that we're all at the extent to which you can constrain that, I think, is good. And so some scheme along those lines, I think, would help.
So you agree with 4A?
I'm not sure that I would make it the second Tuesday. I would probably tie it to an election date. So it would probably be like E minus 147, something like that. I mean, we can work out the exact date. But I really would say that the earliest that they can submit is May 15th. The other advantage to that, whether it's...
Why does it matter?
I don't understand that.
So what if they submit in March? Why is that a problem?
Well, again, in this case, because we've got a redistricting issue, I don't want people coming in. I know we've got legislation now to delay till at least April 15th, but I also would like people to spend some time thinking about the dynamics of a race, not just, oh, I'm in the district, so let me run. But even if it's not in a redistricting year, I think the reasonably later that you make it, not the totally later, but the reasonably later, you don't encourage people to start running like 18 months before. And there are people who have been thinking about it. And
but,
yeah, they
but
can
won't
think
they
about
run
it.
Anyway and just submit their paperwork on May 15th?
They may, but I don't want to have the staff be dealing with all of those questions that early if they are – I mean, it's – as it is now, the staff is having a tough time getting to audits because we're still dealing with all of the ramifications of this stuff. And it's the same staff that does audits as does public finance. That's why I'm trying to have a little bit more of a separation.
Thank you.
It seems to me like jamming them together, if that's what it felt like in the office, would be harder on staff to not be able to take them. You know, if there's a value to a starting gate, I'd be interested in whether staff thought that a month was tight. It seems to me in a race, in a situation where there are a lot of races, that would overcome the value that you're describing. Maybe there's not an infinite period, but a month seems too short.
And if I'm being too sensitive to staff, I apologize, but thank you.
I think giving the staff more time to process the paperwork is better. And you know, candidates that they're not going to get the money till June,
right?
But they need to plan, so they need to know they're going to get the money. So if they qualify early, they won't get it, but they can make plans around knowing that it's going to come in.
I also think that if somebody's ready to do so, then it's not a bad thing for other people to know who's going to be in the race. And if you can't file, whereas filing actually puts you to your proof, then there's a lot of huffing and puffing that could perhaps be done. I'm going to file. I have the, you know, but.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't sort of come to ground. It may be that this is all.
Mr. Givner?
Just following up on two points that Mr. Hill made, just for the commission's information. First is that at one of the interested persons meetings or after one of the interested persons meetings, the staff asked our office whether the city could move the filing deadline for candidates backward, separate from the public financing program, whether we could set the filing deadline for candidates, which is now 88 days before the election or about 81 days before the election if the incumbent isn't running, back to June. And the answer is yes. It's not, as Mr. Hill mentioned, it's not the Ethics Commission doesn't adopt those ordinances. It would be an amendment to the Municipal Elections Code, which the board could do by 6 votes in concert with any public financing amendment or not. The other much more minor point is that the second Tuesday in June is sometimes Election Day, and if the two deadlines are matched so that somebody could get public financing on the second Tuesday, and they would also have to file nomination papers, potential overload issues for the Department of Elections. So as the staff's working through this proposal, coordination with the Department of Elections may be appropriate.
Okay. I mean, I have no objection to third Tuesday or, you know, I think, but it's a good point. Any dissenting views from the commission with respect to 4A?
as the date. Decision point five.
This is a companion decision to decision point two as to the amount of available public funds and then the overall expenditure ceiling. And again, we have examples of how the various scenarios would play out in the appendix on 13 and 14.
Public comment?
I could live with either of these, but I prefer the 250 just because, I don't know, you know, everyone has their own perceptions of these things, what seems expensive to you. And something about 250 just in terms of the public perception seems to me to be perhaps more saleable. 300,000 would actually represent a more than doubling of the current one. And I don't know, I could just see people who are opponents of this making a big deal out of that. But I could be wrong about that, and staff have good reasons for 300,000. So either of these, I think, would be fine.
David Pilpel, I generally agree. And I think if we go with 125, then 250 is a nice correlation. If we go with 150, then that sort of gets you to 300. But I would prefer 250.
Commissioners?
Again, it's not a deal breaker. I agree.
Commissioners?
$250.
$250?
Yeah, I had it for the same reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel a little bit more strongly about $250 than I did about the $125, $150 because this seems to be more. I can understand why a candidate who was viable and didn't have enough, the public match was important. Here, if you've already raised 250, you're essentially giving them another 50 that they can just raise on their own, aside from the cap. And that starts to feel like it's less in line with our goals. But so I also favor 250. Is 300 a deal breaker for any commissioner?
I'd really prefer not to go that high if it's not something. I just don't see a need for it based on the figures or on the sentiment. Like the public, I had actually put on in my notes, it's 300 is double it's over double, and there could be a public perception issue. I had that exactly what one of the speakers said. I had that in my notes. I do feel a little more strongly about this one not going to 300, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Same here.
Okay. Agree. So you have our sentiments on five.
All right. Number six, this is the most controversial of the decisions to be made. clearly, we are going to stop once the candidate reaches the max as detailed of in decision point two. We are not going to give any public funds beyond that stated amount. So that puts us in compliance with Supreme Court. The question then becomes, do we continue to allow the candidates to raise private funds by keeping the individual expenditure ceilings adjustable in order to respond to independent expenditures by third parties or cap breaking by non-PF candidates who are well financed. There's a couple of things to consider. If we say no, we're gonna have a hard cap and that's it, then fine, that's a policy. Easy to recognize, easy to understand. Candidates will choose to opt in or opt out knowing that they will be ultimately limited to apparently 250,000 in supervisorial races. if we opt to continue the adjustment of the independent expenditure ceiling, that's an enhancement that may make it more attractive to candidates beyond what we've already tried to do. The downside is we're vulnerable to a lawsuit. It doesn't go as far as the problems that the Supreme Court has addressed, but it's possible that there could still be a challenge based on that decision if we continue to adjust them. However, our legal advice is that we could probably survive this challenge, where we will almost certainly not survive a legal challenge to the program as it is. But there is that fly in the ointment that we could be vulnerable and then have to fight it. The other thing you need to know is that because we have the adjustable spending caps, we regulate independent expenditures in that every time an independent expenditure is made, the documents generated by those are reported to the commission. Copies of them, a report detailing how much was spent, how much for or against candidates, and that is the barometer we use to do our daily reporting of what the our daily adjustments to the independent expenditures. We have a compelling governmental interest in doing that. Absent this provision, the state says we cannot regulate state committees along these lines. So we will not be able to compel state committees to do regular reporting of their independent expenditures. They will be reported, but in most cases not until after the election. We can regulate local committees, so we could still require them to report, but about half the committees doing business in San Francisco are state committees. So we lose some transparency with a hard cap. So there's a downside to both directions, and there's an upside.
Can you tell us a little bit about the discussion at the interested parties meetings on this provision?
Well, it was kind of one of those, I think this is where people would like to see the adjustable ceiling stay, but there was nobody so adamant about it that they said do this or we're not interested in having a program anymore. So there wasn't any kind of consensus on one or the other. Everybody's going to live with whatever decision is made.
Public comment on this issue?
David Pilpel, I think that's a fair summary. I would actually be a little stronger, though, in saying that I think the adjustable IEC is really important. I think having thought about this in terms of all the various elements of program design, that the hard spending cap makes it a lot less attractive for a candidate, that if they don't know what they don't know, like who knows who's going to be running, if you're just limited to 250 or even 300, but let's say 250, you may have some reason, some compelling reason, not a compelling government interest, but a compelling campaign reason to go beyond that. And if you know you're not going to be able to, you may just say, well, as attractive as the program may be, I'll go it alone. And so I think it's a really important program element to keep people in this, to have the adjustable ceilings and for the disclosure requirements that were laid out. So I understand the risk. I think it is... I don't know all of the nuances of the risk, but I understand there is a risk, but it seems to me like it's a manageable risk. I mean, if somebody really wants to take on this particular program element and fight it all the way, we'll see if we get to that. But I think it's a risk that I would be willing to live with, and I think it's an important part of the program. I would encourage you to keep the adjustable IECs. Thanks.
Well, on this one, you know, when we were, I think having the hard spending cap, it gives the public a reassurance that this much will be spent and no more. And I think that's important. When we were passing this in 2000, we actually polled and we asked voters, for example, would you be willing to spend $1 per San Francisco resident, $2, $3, $4? And they were willing to spend $2, but not $3. And you know, I thought to myself, how do they even conceptualize the difference between $2 and $3? It's just that everyone has their cutoff point, their tipping point. And my fear is that if this has an adjustable expenditure ceiling, it just feels to the public like they're using public dollars, and it could be any amount. It could go who knows where. It's an adjustable expenditure ceiling, and so that really worries me in terms of the public.
Let me stop you there for one second.
Yep.
My understanding is that it would not be matched. So the amounts above the IEC would not be matched.
Right,
I
understand. Public money would not be matched. I understand that, but I think in the public's mind, it still is a matter of, you know, they're getting public money. You know, and but they can, but the amount that they spend isn't capped. I think there, you have a perception problem there. I think also with the Supreme Court decision, you know, no one knows, but this Supreme Court, you know, they are just shooting holes in the campaign finance landscape all the time. And if you actually, you know, when they looked at the, when they made their decision, and you read that decision, what they talked about was the chilling effect on the speech of a candidate when there is a trigger, and that the candidate would have to think, well, if I spend more of my own money, then someone else is going to be able to do X. And they talked about it in terms of X being getting more public money. But when you read their ruling, it's not clear that they aren't also thinking that it would be a chilling effect if it means my opponent would also now be able to spend more money. So, you know, that I think you also have to be really concerned about with this Supreme Court. This is a Supreme Court. I mean, for all we know, there'll be a future ruling where they call into question public financing itself. They didn't do it in this in the Bennett decision, but I think you have to really be aware of that. I understand where John St. Croix is coming from about the reporting of IEs, but it doesn't make sense to me that we can require this sort of reporting because we have a public financing system, but we can't require it because of some other compelling reason, such as public has a right to know. And why can't we rewrite the law requiring them to do the same sort of reporting that they're doing now in such a way that they would still have to do exactly the type of reporting, which is valuable, of course. I mean, is there no way to rewrite this in a way that would allow, would make sure that they are still reporting the way that we think they ought to? So I would like to see that answered more and explore that angle more before we just simply say we're going to keep these adjustable expenditure ceilings, because I think the adjustable expenditure ceilings have problems for the reason I outlined. Thank you.
Commissioners, comments on decision point six?
I mean, I favor the hard cap.
Okay. I mean, this is a tough issue. I do worry that the hard cap might have further consequences with respect to how the entire program is the legislation is drafted and would likely entail some pretty substantial rewriting. Is that, I don't know, Mr. St. Croix, you can speak to that, or Mr. Givner, if you have any thoughts on that.
It's not going to be harder one way or the other to draft.
Well, I think that going with a hard cap, if the commission adopts a hard cap and more restricted reporting of independent expenditures, which is kind of how it's been framed for you, that's a bigger change. That's a bigger legislative change, and involves some decisions about what third party reporting the city would want to still require.
Mr. St. Croix, when you were talking about the compelling state interest required to for this reporting, do you have any thoughts on Mr. Hill's view that there could be a different compelling state interest that would enable us to require the same?
I don't know. I mean, the state law is pretty clear that you can't, municipalities can't regulate state committees. The state says that's reserved for us. In this particular instance, the question of whether we can even do what we already do hasn't been completely answered, because we have gotten compliance more through carrot and stick approach than through actual enforcement.
If I could jump in to follow up on that. The issue isn't so much, and I think Mr. Hill is presenting it as an issue of a First Amendment question. Can we require committees to file reports with us? Is that a violation of the First Amendment? No, it's not. We have compelling state interest to require reporting generally. The question here is a state preemption question, as Mr. St. Croix points out. The state law sets certain reporting requirements for third parties, and the question is, can the city impose additional requirements as a matter of our home rule authority to regulate local campaigns? There are various ways to justify our additional reporting requirements. One of them is one of the central ways that we've justified those requirements in the past is the close linkage between the additional reporting we impose and our public financing program, the need for staff to track third-party spending very closely during the campaign. We would have other arguments to justify our third-party reporting if we went with a hard cap, but one strong argument would be eliminated.
And if the commission wants to go with a hard cap, we'll certainly do what we can to preserve that. But I can't make an ironclad guarantee that it will be preserved.
Mr. Hill?
You know, this might be one issue to give the supervisors a choice on, since there's really good reasons for going either way. I mean, I think the reason you're raising is really a good one. So I'm kind of, you know, mystified myself, which is the best way. And, you know, supervisors might have some real thoughts on it, having been candidates and that kind of thing.
And we could cast it both ways if you want, so you can pass them both and leave it up to them. But it would be up to you. So if you want, we'll just go ahead and do that.
I think that sounds reasonable. I think it's a tough call. I'm inclined toward a hard cap as well, but it starts to get into some fundamental notions about what the idea of the whole thing is. Is it, to the extent that these changes are being required of us, it gets harder and harder to entice people into the system in the first place. And so I'm left wondering, whether we need to entice people to stay in order, if they feel like there's another way that they can be in the race, and maybe our job is to assist the candidates who need it to go from viable, serious, to audible and able to maintain a candidacy, and not to try and hold the ones who are thinking, well, if I don't agree to these terms, I'll have plenty of money. And so the original conception has gotten somewhat more tangled by the things that we're not allowed to do.
I'm less worried about those candidates than I am about the viable candidates who can raise a lot of money. It's not because they're wealthy themselves, but they have a lot of support. They have a lot of experience. And in a heated election where they are viable and they've raised a lot of money, and someone comes in late who is the opposite, is extremely wealthy and who can pay an unlimited amount, you have put them now in a position where they may no longer be viable, even though because of what they've done, they're able to raise the private funds to compete with that candidate, but they couldn't because of the hard cap.
Okay.
That's sort of the person I worry about in this.
David Pilpel again. Yeah, I don't want to beat the dead horse here, but I think if you've got a legally defensible program with a hard cap that nobody participates in or fewer people participate in versus a potentially challengeable program that people do participate in, where is the balance of the public benefit?
I mean, I don't know that people...
I don't know that that's the only way to look at it. It's not.
Yeah. My concern is almost that person doesn't even get in because they're worried about not being able to compete if there's a...
Right.
You know. If
the city's notion in going to all of this trouble is to try to minimize the effect of money on the outcome of races, then I'm trying to say which is the better policy approach, if that's The one thing I'm pretty sure is pretty widely shared. The rest of it is hard to, you know, imagine human nature and when the money comes and who does what and all of the variables, but I'm trying to take it up to the, if that's the point, and if people think there's another point, happy to hear it, then I'm trying to work through which is the better strategy for that, and your comment was helpful.
And if we start with the premise that we like the program as is, but for the Supreme Court decision, then removing the IEC seems like a pretty radical change to some extent.
That was actually my concern, too, that if what we're doing here is just making changes that we need to make changes to in response to what we've seen and all that, whether this is a little bit more of a drastic departure if we go, you know, do away with the adjustable IEC, and that might be something perhaps we need more discussion on or more guidance from as
similarly,
a policy.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it. I think we should go with both.
Okay.
And also just add one other quick thing. If it's possible to do some more outreach to candidates, both winning and losing candidates, I'd be very interested in hearing if a hard cap versus a soft cap was a consideration for them in choosing to participate, or whether they could see that as being a strong consideration in the future. Even in something like District 8 last time around, I mean, just kind of how they think of that. There are lots of other program elements, but that in particular is one that might be worth getting some information on from candidates. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Number seven is the hard fix, if you will, for zombie candidates. With my apologies to people who don't like that expression.
I don't like that expression.
So as the memo says, there's a perverse incentive for non-viable candidates to stay in the race, because once they've spent a chunk of public money, where will they get it to replace it if they have to pay it all back? So this creates kind of an escape hatch. On the last day before the ballot goes to the printer, a candidate who decides that they're not viable, that they want out of the race, can pay their accrued expenses, that is, any unpaid bills that their campaign has, and then whatever they have left they give to the city. Obviously, the downside is if we give a chunk of change to a candidate and they drop out, the taxpayers lose whatever it is they spent. There might be an incentive here for the issue candidates who weren't planning on getting elected to use the system this way. On the other hand, there's a lot of public concern about candidates based on this last mayoral race, where it seemed clear to many people, I'm not going to say everyone, that some candidates didn't have a chance, particularly after Mayor Lee sort of changed the game, if you will. But they had no choice but to stay in. I would venture to say if you ask any of those people, they would decry the idea that they were a zombie candidate and say, no, I was in it to win it. But having said all of that, this would be one way to alleviate this perceived problem. And I say perceived because we've only had, it's never come up in the supervisorial races, although you can find candidates that would fit the descriptor. So is this an anomaly of this race? In which case it's not a problem, doesn't really need to be addressed. On the other hand, is it a real problem? And we may not know for 4 years, because there may not be, if there's a mayoral race with an incumbent in 4 years, there may not be a wide field. We're not sure. So the question is, do you want to put this escape hatch in? And for the reasons I stated, there's ups and downs to both sides.
Public comment? Did you have a public comment on this matter?
David Pilpel, I'm a big proponent of this provision. I probably came up with the quote about the perverse incentive. I think we should do this. I think we can tweak the language so it does all the things that director wants. I'm totally cool with that. I think part of the idea here is, again, not to limit the total number of candidates, but to sort of cull it to a number of viable candidates, whether it's in District 10 last year or potentially District 5 next year or District 7 more specifically, which, you know, will have no incumbent, presumably, to have so many candidates that, you know, obviously only one candidate's going to win, so all these other candidates are going to lose, to have that large number that's all using public funds and trying to be viable. I'm not sure giving that many choices is great, and having a process that tends to winnow at least a little bit seems like it serves an important public purpose. I'm not trying to get everybody out of the contest, certainly not, but at some point if they make a reasonable judgment that they're just not happening, they should be able to exit gracefully and not continue in this way. The date that I would pick, again, is E-minus 60, which I think is the last date under the existing election code that someone can withdraw from the race with elections and not be listed on the ballot. If there's a form that they fill out there could be a similar form at Ethics on that date to say, I hereby withdraw from the public finance program and will agree to all of these conditions and give you what money is left in short order when we've determined that. And I think we can make that work. I would encourage you to adopt this decision point. Thanks.
I have mixed feelings about this one. I can see it both ways. I've asked a lot of people about it, try to get people's views, and the opinions have been pretty split. With some people saying, yeah, I think it could be a good thing, and others, the ones who are against it seem to be more viscerally against it, like, no, that's a terrible idea. Interestingly, some of the candidates who we would think of as some of those zombies, the ones who I've asked, they thought it was a good idea. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that I could see it working out, you know, in a good way, and others, you know, it just takes one candidate who gets into the race, runs until late August, spends a bunch of money, and then pulls out, to have people say, what a waste of money that was. So, you know, I think it could work either way. It could, you know, it could work in some elections where it worked out well and people pulled out and no one thought anything because they really thought that person was running sincerely. And another race where someone may clearly abuse it, and suddenly you'll have the Examiner or the Chronicle, whomever, writing ridiculous articles about it. So, yeah, it's, I had one other thing, but I can't remember what it is. But anyway, good luck in deciding that one.
I have some questions about how this works, but go ahead. You first. Well, it seems to me the title, at the very least, is allowing a publicly funded candidate who withdraws to pay accrued debts with public funds. And then I would go even further, maybe not in the title, but is this the natural ramification? Even if the candidate has private funds available to use toward payment of such debts. Meaning, somebody has qualified for public funds, they are sitting on a campaign chest of resources, they want to go. It's a barrier, it's the problem we're trying to solve, that they would have to repay all of the public funds. But if they have money that they have raised sitting there, I'm wondering why they don't have to use that first and then have the public money available to them if they needed to pay genuine campaign debts back. The way you summarized it, Mr. St. Croix said, and whatever's left over, they have to give to the city. Well, if that's how it came out, it would just be a wash and it wouldn't matter. But I thought it was they can pay their own debts to themselves, and then they can give it back to their contributors. So they would have taken, so they'd be able to take, give the contributors back their money and spend the city's money for their debts, rather than use their campaign contributions first and the city money only if they needed it to finish out paying back those debts.
I understand. Yeah.
So is that really how it would work, and is that intended, or is this?
The way you're describing it is what we intended. The idea
is what they can do. And
yeah. What we were concerned about is we don't want them to use public money to pay themselves back if they make a loan to their campaign.
I thought they could.
They shouldn't. No, we don't want them to be able to do that. If they return 100% of the public funds and they still have money left over, they can repay loans.
Okay.
That they made themselves. This isn't worded ideally.
After such repayment. Okay, after such repayment to the city of the public funding, then if the candidate has any funds from private sources left over, the candidate could repay personal loans.
Right.
Then return any remaining external private contributions to those donors or give it to the city. I see what you mean. That sentence made me think after the repayment of debts to printers and consultants and staff, then if you've got anything left over, then you can pay private debts, that it's only from private funds.
So the idea is you can pay all of your accrued expenses from your campaign, and then you have to give all of it back to the city up to the amount you got in public funds. If there's anything left over after you repay the city, then you can pay loans.
So my question, my dilemma is answered by the intent. I think you're right that it needs to be clarified after what such repayment is.
Right. See, the problem is that, let's say I'm a candidate and I get $100,000, 50 of it was from the city and 50 was private. And you tell me, and then I decide to drop out of the race, and you tell me I have to use the private funds first to pay my accrued expenses. Once you start spending money, you don't say this dollar is public, this dollar isn't. So
I understand that,
the way we do it, we would get where you want to go, but the candidate doesn't have to specifically say, I'm using private funds to repay these loans. Because if they have any money at all, up to including what they got, it has to come to the city.
But why, if the candidate has $50,000 in private funds, why can't we, that were given to them for the purpose of running this race as best they could, why would having to use that money raised for the campaign deter them from dropping out using that $50,000 first? I think I understand, but
if they have the $100,000 and they spend $50,000 and they decide to drop out of the race, where did that last $50,000 that they still have in the bank come from? They can say, well, the $50,000 I spent was the private funds. I haven't spent any of the public money yet.
No, but we can tell them how to count it. We can tell them it's spend all private first and give back whatever is left up to the amount the public gave you.
Well, they're going to give us every single thing they have anyway up to the amount they got from the city.
After they pay their debts.
Excepting they can't pay the loans that they made. So if there's any money left over, in all likelihood there's not going to be, after they pay the city back, they're essentially converting their loan to a contribution.
But I think there is a different scenario, and that's somebody who has enough private money to pay their accrued expenses and then would give all of the city's money back.
So in that situation, I think what Mr. St. Croix is saying, that the city's going to get paid back in full regardless, because if you have enough money to pay your debts and pay back the city, that is the only circumstance under which you get
Got
the...
It. Okay. Okay. Then I can live with this, with that clarification that it's not city money paying your own personal loans.
This doesn't seem like a good idea to me for two reasons. One, I'm worried that this actually encourages the kind of candidacy that Commissioner Hand was talking about, where you're running to get name recognition, and then you drop out before the embarrassment of actually having to be on the ballot and getting 10 votes. And I think it does encourage soapbox candidates, too, who get there, and they don't want to be on the ballot either. They just want to have their moment in the sun. I'm also not sure it's a problem, and I'm hopeful that some of the other fixes we have, like raising the amount to get into the race or expanding the base of contributors, may alleviate some of the concerns we have about too many candidates in races getting public funds who aren't viable. So this seems, I guess, I could see needing something like this if really it was a problem and it turned out to be a problem and these other fixes weren't working. But for now, it seems premature to me. And I really do worry about, I mean, some of the concerns you were raising in your questions about, I think even if they're technically solvable, there is going to be a big public perception problem with having, this public money going to candidates who aren't in the race.
Although if they leave the race, they stop getting more public money than they, and what we took heat for was by the end they got significant amounts of public money and the attractiveness to the voters was modest, shall we say. So it's another way to look at it, I think it is, sure. I think you're absolutely right, is whether you can stanch the flow and cut the city's unnecessary expenditure on the assumption that letting the person get in and be heard is a positive investment, right? If the amount of money never changed from day 60 to election day, then I'd be with you completely. But because we continue, if I'm
right,
and that's somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, we continue to money continues to flow if they're getting contributions, although those contributions may taper off if the if people understand that their chances aren't great. But we could be continuing to contribute, and then looks like why did we compel them to stay in the race, or why didn't we make it easier for them to get out?
Do we know what those figures were like in the mayor's race, the amount of money that was matched sort of after the day ballots were printed versus before for sort of candidates who got fewer than 5%?
There were a couple candidates who were strong out at the beginning and some who didn't really pick up until later on. Mm-hmm.
But there's no real correlation with how they...
No.
I mean, that's a concern. I hear that. Mr. Pilpel, did you have...
Yeah. I'm sorry that we sort of ran through this initially a little quickly, because this is sort of the culmination of a number of moving concepts. I would think that a decision to pull out of a contest is not really related to the money, but it's the dynamics of the race changed. So, again, touching on the mayor's race, a candidate, let's say, I don't know, Michaela Elliott-O'Pierre, might have thought, I'm really great and viable at that time, and then when Ed Lee decided to run, the dynamics of the race changed, and given rational choices one could have made, she might have, and I'm not saying she would have, but she might have said, this really isn't happening anymore. Let's find a way to respectfully end this. And my concept in bringing this was that you take the surplus funds rule that already exists in law. Surplus funds exist as of the day after the election for non-elected candidates, to just move that date up and treat the money in a surplus funds manner at an earlier point in time. And I think Jack's concerns was that you aren't, that you're subordinating the public investment to a greater degree, and that's why the public funds payback was moved up higher in the hierarchy. That was, I think, the only meaningful tweak to the surplus funds concept. And clearly we could sit through and try to figure out some other ways to approach this, but the concept was to just move that action and all that flows from it to an earlier point in time if a candidate decides in their judgment that they've become not so viable. I hope that helps. I acknowledge that it's complicated in concept and how it plays out. Thanks.
Mr. Hill?
One additional point that might be useful for you to think about. In my survey of people, especially for those who didn't like this idea, I said to some of them, what if the candidates had to sign a pledge at the beginning and at the end saying, I'm a publicly financed candidate, I pledge to use the money to advance my candidacy and to fulfill the goals of the campaign finance reform ordinance, you know, something worded along those lines. And then when they pull out, they would have to sign another pledge saying, I used the funds to further my candidacy and to further the goals of the campaign finance reform ordinance. You know, it's not like it would have any sort of legal effect on them, but it would be kind of a public shaming thing, the impact of public shaming. And for some of the people who said, no, I don't like that idea, they said, yeah, that would make it better for me. So whether it would or not, ultimately, I throw that out there for you to think about.
If it was humiliating, I don't know that anybody would do it, so right. I don't think it would work the way we would want it to.
I have a question of to Mr. Hill. On the people that you interviewed who were adamantly against this idea, this concept, what were the reasons that they gave, other than just it's a bad idea?
It was kind of the moral hazard issue, you know. Oh, someone will get in the race, just take the money, hire their friends, family. You know, one person said to me, oh, the political consultant will get someone to jump into the race just so the political consultant can get money. And so there was just this sense that people would game it to get the money as more of an employment act and actually be a viable candidate and to run. So that was, they were all along those sorts of lines, kind of a moral hazard.
And, I mean, it combined, and we talked about this earlier, but combined with our proposal to...
100 people.
Pardon me?
You'd have to have the 100 people.
Well, right, right. But I think it's going to be easier to get to 100 now if the board adopts our proposal to remove the limit on how many candidates you can contribute to. I think raising that money is going to be easier, and I think you do... raise the moral hazard of lots of people trying to raise this money and people who are giving the money not necessarily having to choose horses early on since they can give to more people.
Too many variables.
Yeah, I'm really persuaded by Mr. St. Croix's assertion and that it hasn't been a problem so far in supervisorial races, or at least not a blatant problem. And also that this mayoral election was a bit unique in many circumstances. And I'm not sure that we can take this election as sort of a standard for what's going to happen down the road. So I am definitely in favor of saying no to decision point 7 at this point. And, you know, I think it's something that could be revisited down the road if it proves to be a problem, but I would hate to create a situation where we, you know, potentially create a moral hazard that people jump through without a very clear indication that there's a problem to be solved.
I don't feel strongly, and I do on another item later, have a little note to myself about letting the most immediate race recede into a larger picture, because our noses are up against it pretty closely, and it may not be the best way to make longer-term policy. So I see some attraction, but I could agree. But the attraction is probably more perception than it is campaign management.
I'm fine with tabling it for now, too.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Decision point eight.
Okay. The rest of these are mirrors, mayoral decisions that you've already made for supervisor.
Right.
So, for example, eight would be a doubling increase like we talked about for supervisor. We hadn't considered mayoral candidates being, we'd thought mayoral candidates might even be more difficult, make it more difficult, which is why there's two different thresholds there. Obviously, we hadn't considered the commission's idea about a dual qualifying scenario that you came up with during the discussion at the Board of Supervisors. So I'm not sure if you wanted to extend that to the mayoral program or not.
When your last sentence says until staff is able to obtain additional data, staff is not prepared to make a recommendation on which the amount should be. This is the one where I said, do we have time to look at this with some additional analysis, finish the work on this, see what the supervisor's reaction is to the set related to the supervisorial races, and then have a little more distance. Do you need a decision on this one?
Well, we're not going to have another mayoral race for 4 years, so the immediacy isn't there. But the question was, do you want to, as we do this, do you want to, you know, like sew it up completely or leave some decisions for a future commission?
When would you have additional data?
In 8 years. 4 years or 8 years.
Wait, but additional data.
I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. I apologize. The staff does after every public financing program, the staff does a complete report. So that's usually ready by March.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I don't feel a hunger to make additional decisions on this tonight.
I mean, I think Commissioner Sudley and Commissioner Liu make a good point. I mean, if and especially if that data would be available in March, mm-hmm. and it would inform the decision, mm-hmm. seems like tabling it is a good idea.
All right. Okay.
Can I make one comment?
Sure.
The
public comment.
You know, I think pretty much every member of the board understands that it needs to go up from the 25. And between the 50 and 80, I think you might find a difference of opinion. But I don't think increasing it to at least 50 is controversial among the board. And, you know, I think they're going to be coming forward with proposal as well along these lines. So whatever you can do to have yours as soon as possible so that you know, everything is working kind of in tandem would be great.
Mr. Pilpel?
So collapsing all of this together, 8, 9, and 10, I guess, I used the factor of 8 because it seemed to me that there are some things that you can scale up by 5. There are other things maybe by 11. Somewhere between 5 and 11, you find 8. I'm also told it's a lucky number in Chinese community and want to be very supportive. So I just thought multiplying the whole program times 8 kind of made some sense. When I looked at the either 500 or 800 contributors or 50,000 or 80,000, that's actually where I got to the E-minus 70 versus E-minus 60 problem, that if you really run at the last minute, that you really don't have enough time. I mean, it's kind of hard enough running for Board of Supes, but if you're running for mayor to score 500 or 800 contributions in 18 days is a lot to ask for, and that's where I came up with the other 10 days. I did start to look at contributions, at least from 2011. It was a very complicated formula to come up with, and it's got some data limitations because candidates don't report on their 460s contributions of less than 100. They're not required to. And there are instances where you get two $50 checks. I was not easily able to get the second check out. I was able to cap it at 100 with a minimum of 10, but then there are other instances where they pay where they refund contributions, you have to pull that out. It gets very dicey. Plus, there were candidates who started running in 2009 and 2010. I wasn't able to capture all of that earlier data, so my initial analysis is a little mixed, and that's why I wasn't prepared to offer that tonight. But I did want to have some information on what date candidates this cycle got to 25, 50, 75, or 80,000. That was my intention to pull that together, and I talked to Mabel about that last week. I still think that 80,000 and 800 makes sense, but I recognize that that's a significant increase in burden, and that actually encourages people running for mayor, unfortunately, to start running earlier and to be serious about it. But frankly, if you I don't know about the 800 contributions. I think that still makes sense. But if you aren't raising at least $80,000 by some early date and you're running for mayor, then you're probably not serious about it either. So then we're back to the what's a serious or viable candidate. These are good issues to discuss, and there aren't perfect answers, but there are different viewpoints on it. I hope that's helpful. Thanks.
You know, I still think given that, and even if people recognize that this has to go up, I still think we want to propose the number that we think makes the most sense. And if the staff thinks that there may be a number above 50,000 or between 50 and 80 or 80, I think we should give the staff the opportunity to look at the data to make that recommendation. I mean, unless, Mr. Sinclair, you're going to, you know, it's you think the timing is such that it's better to do it all at once, and there are good reasons to make it.
Well, the staff proposal is the 50,000, and maybe that's not as clear, but there were arguments made for a higher number at the interested persons meeting, so we brought them both forward.
I see.
My question: I believe we need to raise this threshold. But my unanswered question is, do you want to have a split a qualification process as you have recommended for the Board of Supervisors?
So is your inclination to do it tonight after we see whether we play it out? I just don't want to – I realize that I'll be thinking out loud if I try and do this.
Right, yeah. I mean, my recommendation is to table the mayoral expenditure limit unless staff feels strongly that putting it – doing it all together is –
No, but we'll bring it back to you as soon as humanly possible.
Okay.
Would you send one piece, the Board of Supervisors piece, up first?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as we're ready to go on that, we're going to go on it.
Right.
Okay. So, and given that we're not meeting till the end of January, maybe that's why you want us to also discuss this issue of whether we should have an alternative mechanism for qualifying in the mayoral race?
Yeah, it's. I mean, we hadn't thought about it before. Obviously, it was just introduced tonight. But the it's the same program. It's just that the numbers are different
for right.
the two mm-hmm. offices. So there's less of an urgency for the mayor's race because we do have more time. But on the other hand, there's, you know, getting a meeting of the minds at the board on one occasion is going to be enough of a hurdle, let alone trying to do it twice. So that's
right. I mean, I guess my concern.
No, go ahead.
To me, and maybe this shouldn't matter, but it sort of matters what number we end up with for the mayoral race, because if you have a requirement that they have to have 800 contributions. If we use the same 1.5x times contributions formula for qualifying at a lower dollar amount that we're using for the supervisor race, you're talking about 2,000 contributions, which sounds, I mean, almost, I would be worried that it would be so large as to not seem serious.
And my question comes even earlier. If, since this is something that hasn't been discussed, if the supervisors heard that proposal and said it just doesn't sound like it's a reasonable way to go, why agonize our way through the mayor, the issue related to the mayor's race, if we may learn that it just holds no appeal or doesn't seem to serve the interest of the campaign finance system? So I'm just trying to think, will we spend a lot more effort right now if we try and think it through without a big piece of information, which is it may not have wings, legs, pick your body part at all. But you know better, Jack, what you think the timing is going to be, whether you want us to come up with something so that you can develop it. I mean, there could be differences between the two kinds of races. I mean, is a citywide race is, they are more professionalized. It may be harder to generate the kind of grassroots. Mm-hmm. People might do a supervisor's race as their first effort, but are less likely to in a mayoral race. But that's a longish conversation, and we may have some baseline that says there's no whatsoever, and we might just be more efficient not to tackle it tonight.
And whether we have figures for numbers of contributors, like somebody had said earlier, that we don't even know if 250 or 500, what is the average mm-hmm. number of contributors for a successful campaign on either level.
I guess, so are we comfortable, or is it a, I guess, are we comfortable sending this up to the board without the mayoral piece?
That's your decision. That's,
So that's just a policy decision. Yeah. There are no sort of other implications as far as you can see?
No. Again, it'd be easier to do it in one package. It's not necessary. The impetus for the mayoral race is not there as much as for the supervisor. We kind of have to solve the supervisor problem now.
Some information that might be interesting and useful to you in thinking about this. There is a lot of reform sentiment at the Board of Supervisors right now. And there's going to be ballot measures, it looks like, June 2012, dealing with lots of these issues. And some of those, what exactly is going to be in them is still being discussed, but I think it's very likely you're going to see introduced at the Board of Supervisors in January a ballot measure for the exact things you were talking about here. No, it won't be tomorrow. And it's going to include the mayor's race, in part because a lot of the perception of the zombie candidate stuff is coming from the mayor's race, and so that's the immediate tension, if you will, that's pushing this to the forefront of everything else. And so if you don't come forward with your proposal for the mayor, you risk sort of being left behind by the sweep of events. I don't know how else to say it, but that's just the reality of what's going on. And, probably on, like January 10th, a proposal is going to be introduced, an ordinance that will need four votes at the Board of Supervisors. An ordinance only needs four votes. No, a charter amendment needs six.
An ordinance to be placed on the ballot needs six votes. Four board members may place an ordinance on the ballot with four votes, but that's a different process, different deadline.
Well, no, but the ordinance that would be put on the ballot would be a four-vote ordinance.
Either way, there's a six vote. You can put something on the ballot. Sorry.
Okay. It could take as little as four supervisors, one way or the other, to do it. So, and I think that the supervisors would really love to have the Ethics Commission part of the process and weighing in with your thoughts on what would be the appropriate
numbers for the mayor's race. You know, and it's going to be looking at changing qualifying deadlines for candidates, all these sorts of things. So I think that this is, you know, people are looking to guidance from you, but if you wait till March, it will be too late. I mean, it's the best way of saying it.
So it's not our timetable.
Well, I'm going for another talk. Right.
Well, so, Mr. Hill, then, how would you propose we come up with a number? How do we come up with the right number?
Using your skills and experience and talents at your disposal, and knowing that, you know, we are, I mean, you can look at past elections, the 2003 election. We can at least look now at what candidates spent, though some of the reporting is still out there. But it's coming in. I mean, we have a pretty good sense. And, you know, the numbers that you're talking about are not that different from what it already is. Keep in mind that what you're trying to do in many ways is fix the trigger. So if the trigger is gone, what are you going to give to candidates to make it satisfying and of interest because the trigger is gone? And, you know, I think most people recognize that $25,000 is too low. So your best guess... you know, they recognize there's not that much data for the mayor's race. We don't have mayor's races every 2 years. We have them every 4 years, and the last one before this one was not competitive. So I don't think anybody is going to be harshly critical of you because somehow your numbers aren't founded on two decades of data, you know. They're just looking for guidance, and, they, you know, as always, it's more of an art than a science.
That's a good point, and do commissioners have further thoughts on that?
Well, I think his argument is compelling. I think that we need to be relevant and not be left behind. That seems important to get out in front of the issue rather than behind it.
And it does sound like the staff. At this point, is comfortable with at least 50,000 and 500 contributors. I suppose if that changed down the road, we could amend the proposal. But if this is going to be considered, and you know, we certainly want to be on the right timetable here.
I think that I would suggest at least adopting 8A, 9A. And 10A on the staff's recommendation. Let us put that together, and you can think about it for the next month. And you know,
okay, 8A,
8A, 9A, and 10A.
I'd be comfortable with 8A, 9A, and 10A. The 8A, I guess right now I wouldn't be inclined to go over 50 because. I mean, that we just would have doubled it, and so I don't know about justifying even a more drastic jump in just the qualifying threshold amount
without the additional data.
to know how things could have changed.
I'm fine with that, too. I think the parallelism with the supervisor race makes sense. 80 just, we would hate to regret it and discover it was difficult and real and not be able to read a future.
Right.
And as far as the parallel provision to an alternate doorway in, if that idea has appeal, that's something that could be added later because there are several years to go. I don't think agonized.
Yeah, and I think
events
are,
may overtake it,
and I think there could be distinctions between the mayor's race and the supervisor race. What is the status? So, what all is pending right now in terms of different proposals? And I guess one or two are at the board right now.
The two proposals that are pending at the board right now are the two proposals that the Ethics Commission has already adopted: the changes to the reporting requirements and the changes to the deadline in light of the redistricting task force's work for this election.
Okay.
There are no other pending proposals currently introduced at the board to change the public financing program other than those two that you've already approved. the deadline for introducing charter amendments for June is Tuesday, tomorrow. These changes don't have to be in a charter amendment. The deadline for introducing ordinances at the board for the June election is January 10th. And then, as I mentioned, there's a separate process where four supervisors can put a ordinance on the ballot. And the deadline for those four supervisor ordinances, as we call them, is January 17th. So public financing, we could see a public financing ballot measure introduced on the 10th or the 17th. Or, of course, a board member at any time could introduce a public financing amendment that would go through you and then go back to the board for a supermajority.
And then wasn't there a Supervisor Kim had a proposal, a public financing?
That failed. That did not pass the Ethics Commission. So that, you never took
about,
a vote on
there's
it.
I read something in one of these memos that something was pending at the Rules Committee. No? Okay. I must have misread it.
A Kim thing that's alive.
Top of page 3.
Top of page 3.
Generally, when a board member introduces legislation that has to go to ethics, they wait for it to pass ethics before they bring it to a board committee. So that
it's been referred. They haven't had any hearings or anything on it.
Okay, yeah. And you have had a hearing, and I think ultimately didn't take a vote on it. So you could. But that proposal, of course, raises a lot of the issues that you're already talking about today.
Okay, but that's still floating around somewhere. Okay.
Let's take public comment on 8, 9, and I think we've done 8, but 9 and 10, and then we can deal with them as a group.
So, David Pilpel again. In concept, I am with 8B, 9B, and 10C, but if you're going with the 50,000, at least for the moment, I can certainly live with the 8A, 9A, 10A approach. They're kind of all related, and it's, you know, colors and flavors. The other two points of information that I wanted to bring up, there will likely be charter amendments introduced tomorrow related to ranked choice, which doesn't directly bear on this, except that it all sort of does work together into how we elect people. And I can't predict how that's all going to float out. Stay tuned, I guess. I would encourage the commission, assuming that staff and city attorney can process all that we're getting tonight, to possibly have a special meeting before January 23rd to look at actual legislation to do this stuff, so that if there are items introduced January 10th or 17th, that they've been informed by not just the commission's giving direction tonight, but actually voting on stuff if you've got stuff to vote on, like prior to January 10th. Which you could do, and I just wanted to give you that option. The other thing that I was going to refer to that I wasn't planning to refer to, but since it came up in relation to the alternative qualifying approach, on page 2, the footnote refers to the signature requirement concept that we kicked around for a while and are not currently pursuing. There is an existing process that I assume you're all somewhat familiar with, the petition in lieu process that board and mayoral candidates can use to reduce their filing fee. For Board of Supes, I believe the filing fee is $500, and so 1,000 signatures completely waives their filing fee, and some candidates choose to do that, or at least some amount of that, to prorate their filing fee, and that involves going out and gathering signatures during a roughly 28-day period of time in July-ish.
What's the point, Mr. Philippel?
My point is that it is not unusual for people to have to go out and gather signatures or get the equivalent of small contributions, so it's not a ridiculous concept. If you apply that formula that we're talking about to the mayor's race, the mayoral filing fee, I think, is $5,000, and so 10,000 signatures waives the filing fee. And I don't actually know this year if any of the mayoral candidates, I assume some submitted signatures. I don't know if anyone submitted the full 10,000, but that's an interesting piece of data that we could pick up. So going to Commissioner Studley's point, gathering 2,000 plus signatures or small contributions is not completely outside the realm. Sorry, a long-winded way to get to my point.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can I propose they turn off the air conditioning? I think it's December, isn't it? I could live with any of these numbers.
We may lose a couple commissioners if we don't.
Pardon?
Yeah.
We may lose a couple commissioners here if we don't.
Yeah.
It's locked.
Yeah.
It's really cold in here. I should have brought gloves. So, you know, 9 A, B, and C, I can live with either of those. I was the one that proposed 9 C in part because it was the same thinking. If we're going to take away the trigger, we should give them something, and 9 A is already the status quo. But there's some who feel that there's a perception issue if you hit the $1 million mark, and maybe there is. I don't know. So, I don't know how the members of the board will feel about this. So you might give them a couple of those, 900,000 plus one of the other ones, maybe 9C, since it's different than it's more different than 9A. And then similarly with 10A, 10B, and 10C, I think 10A or 10B is what would be best. 2 million seems like too much to me. It's not that different than 10B, but you hit the 2 million mark and maybe it triggers other people's psychological limits. So 10A or 10B. And maybe give the board a choice on those as well. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioners, comments on 8, 9, and 10? I guess 9 and 10. Sounds like we've agreed on 8 to propose the 50,000.
Well, I would go with the lower amounts just from the sake of public perception. At this point, you know, and some of this could possibly change 4 years from now. And there's obviously time to do that, but that would be my bent.
Any disagreement with that? I agree with that too. Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much to the public for your hard work on this, your comments here and the work you did before getting here. I think it was extremely helpful. And, of course, the staff for the hard work you guys put in hosting those meetings and doing a lot of legwork. I think the proposals, by and large, are very well thought through and strong. So thank you for that. The next item on the agenda is a closed session.
Sorry.
David Pilpel
again. On page 12, there's a section on other issues. Those were actually two things that I had suggested, and the staff was kind enough to include that. And I'm just wondering if the commission would choose to give any direction on whether or not to pursue those items at this time. This was two of three. There was a third item that we've agreed to defer
time. Why don't we give you a couple minutes to make your best points about those?
Okay. With regard to the first one, there was at least one mailer that a candidate, David Chu, for example, did about with a hologram piece about shaking things up at City Hall that apparently was not recyclable, was effectively trash. And if a city department had put that out for any reason, he would have probably been appropriately annoyed and said that violated our environmental policies. It seems to me that if we're spending public money in this instance, city departments would be subject to various Buy Green requirements. Should we not impose something like that, may not be exactly the same, but something like that on candidates who receive public funds? We could certainly consult with Department of the Environment. We could craft something that either says you will use recyclable paper or explain why you're not. That was the first concept, and the other was similar to the local hire legislation of Supervisor Avalos. again, if this were a project that a city department were doing, PUC, MTA, whatever, they would be required to hire at least, to spend at least half the money hiring local folks. As it is now, candidates can receive public funds and have their stuff printed, mailed, use consultants from out of town, et cetera, not keeping the money in town. Why would we not subject candidates receiving public funds to use at least half of the money that they're receiving, let's say, or something like that, locally? We should be stimulating the local economy rather than that elsewhere. Those seemed like reasonable kinds of requirements to impose on candidates, and we could certainly work out how that works, but I ask you for your thoughts on whether or not that's worth pursuing at this time.
Thank you. Comments from the commissioners?
My comment goes not to the merits of the policies behind the two provisions. I wonder if the Board of Supervisors has the authority to implement these requirements. It seems to me that this does not fall within the purview of ethics policies, and therefore our expertise does not lie in these. The amount of research we would have to do them sensibly seems unreasonable, and somebody else whose job it is to worry about local hire and recycling could do so and consult us about whether there were election implications or ethics implications rather than the other way around. That would be my reaction.
Comments?
Well, I think those are well-meaning ideas and perhaps some pledge. We could ask candidates to pledge to do both of these things. Again, I don't know who would follow up on making sure that they, actually do it. So that would be my only question, as with with Commissioner Studley.
Yeah, I agree that it's not something we should take up now. The next item on the agenda is a closed session. Is there a motion to go into closed session?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Oh, public comment, sorry. None? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Got to turn that off.
Like your time, Mr. Chatfield. Good luck.
Back in open session, is there a motion for the Ethics Commission to find that it is in the best interest of the public not to disclose its closed session deliberations?
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Public comment.
Oh, public comment.
David Pilpel, is there any announcement out? That's what's important
yes.
to me.
There will be an announcement.
Okay. It actually might be helpful if we could have the announcement out first and then disclose. Whatever. Thank you.
We can do that. Doesn't matter. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None? Mr. St. Croix?
Okay. Announcement. Finding of probable cause for Ethics Commission complaint 25-101021 at its regular meeting of December 12, 2011 in the matter of Ethics Complaint number 25-101021. The Ethics Commission made a determination that there is probable cause to believe the following violations of San Francisco Campaign and Governmental Conduct Code, and that the respondent, Patrick Cullum, committed them. One, two violations of Section 1.510, the first for providing campaign consulting services or accepting any economic consideration for the provision of campaign consulting services without first registering with the Ethics Commission. the second for failing to comply with the reporting requirements specified in section 1.515. Two, one violation of the code section 1.515A for failing to file a campaign consultant registration report. Three, one violation of the code section 1.515C for failure to pay campaign consultant registration and client fees. Four, one violation of the code section 1.515D for failure to file campaign consultant client authorization statement. And five, two violations of the code section 1.515E for failure to file two campaign consultant quarterly reports. Each commissioner who participated in a decision to provide to find probable cause must certify on the record that he or she personally heard or read the testimony, reviewed the evidence, or otherwise reviewed the entire record of the proceedings. So I so swear.
I so swear.
Yeah. I so swear.
I so swear.
I so swear.
The respondent is presumed to be innocent unless and until such time that the allegations are proved in a subsequent hearing on the merits. The executive director shall issue an accusation in accordance with the San Francisco Ethics Commission regulations for investigations and enforcement proceedings.
The next... We took public comment on this already, right?
You don't need public comment on that.
Yeah. The next item on the agenda is the minutes of the commission's regular meeting, November 14th, 2011. Any proposed changes to the minutes? Public comment? Is there a motion to approve the minutes, November 14th, 2011?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. The executive director's report.
Okay. Just one highlight tonight. Because the meeting happened after the document was reported, we did have a department head budget meeting. Just want to let you know that while the overall budget outlook has improved for the city, we're still looking at deficits in the next 2 years in the hundreds of millions range. So each department has been given a target for the upcoming year to cut 5% from its budget and then an additional 5% for the second year. As you may recall, starting this calendar year, we're going to two-year budgeting cycles in the city. In addition to that first 5% cut and then 5% for the second year, we've been directed to prepare a 2.5% contingency cut. Again, these are much smaller than cuts requested in the past, but it's still problematic for an agency as small as ours. The overwhelming majority of our budget is salary and staff, and that's almost certainly where that would come from, which means even if 5% didn't take up a whole position, we would likely lose a staff member. I'll be having talks with the mayor's budget and finance office to look at the lay of the land a little closer to the ground. At the January meeting, I'll have a budget proposal prepared for you. So this is just an FYI that's what's out there. As I said, things are looking better for the city, but far from out of the woods yet as far as those things go.
Thank you, Mr. St. Croix. And thank you for, again, the staff, all the work you guys do. We know it's already a tight budget, and these are not going to be easy decisions. Any comments from the commissioners with respect to the executive director's report? Public comment?
David Pilpel. So first, to start with the disclosure from a moment ago, I assume that will be placed on the website as soon as possible.
It'll be posted tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. I've commented before, and I didn't want to forget that, although the website does disclose accusations and settlements, what it doesn't do, among other things, is indicate for settlements whether they have been finally handled. So if a committee or a respondent agreed to pay a certain amount or file a form or something, whether that has actually been closed out and whether they've done the thing that they agreed to do, something putting something like that on the website, I think, would be helpful to just indicate that as of X date, all of the terms have been adhered to and this item is closed out, because it's just not clear right now whether those things happen. Moving on to the written report, with respect to the budget, I understood there was actually one additional requirement that the director did not mention, that there's something about a 1 or 1.5% position cut for general fund supported departments. Is that, am I correct in that understanding?
I don't remember that.
Okay. Anyway, I'd heard that they were looking for body count, was the point.
They did say there were going to be additional positions cut.
Okay.
They made that clear, but there was no directive that each department had to lose X number of.
Oh, okay. All right. Because I'd heard that, and that worried me, because the only way we make things happen here is with, you know, staff. The other thing that, again, occurs to me with the written report, looking at the BDR referrals, for some reason we now have three either former or current elected members of the College Board that are in the BDR doghouse. That's a technical term. I think we should explore some way to bring them into compliance and see why is it that the College Board of all places seems to result in these problems. I mean, at least two of these individuals, if they run again, need to correct these problems before they can be elected again. And one of them is no longer in office. But still, it's troubling that someone who's elected to the College Board is not complying in that way, more so than these other folks who were not elected or are general purpose committees. I just find that interesting. Thanks.
Items for future meetings. Commissioner Studley?
I have a suggestion. It's possible that it's being overtaken by events that were described to us earlier. But after the last meeting, Commissioner Hahn and I had a brief conversation in light of all of this discourse in the city and through editorials and so forth, where people were asking about the purposes and effectiveness of the campaign finance system adopted by the voters some years ago, and wondered whether the Ethics Commission might want to play a part in some wider conversation, in creating some forum for people to actually hear the pros and cons, go back to first principles, and look at whether it's still accomplishing what people want. That may be a better idea if there are ballot initiatives coming. It may be precluded if there are actually ordinances, and we, even in a nonpartisan, non-substantive, keep our hands off it. But I just wanted to kind of capture the thought. Commissioner Hahn said, we were talking about doing it with others. She had a thought about how we might co-sponsor it. Could be done with, you know, organizations like university think tanks. She had another idea, about the Commonwealth Club. If we did the Commonwealth Club, I might also want to do some neighborhood version, but not looking for a time-consuming activity, because I know that staff resources are modest, but the goal would simply be to have the most thoughtful conversation possible and have some real perspective on issues that, as I said earlier, we might be making a lot of decisions with our vantage point very close to one particular race, and we might be able to work with others who care about these kinds of issues to just broaden the thinking. And I haven't gone beyond that idea at all, but I now realize that there may be some things going on that make it either more desirable and necessary or less possible for us to be the ones who do it.
Are there any restrictions on holding such a forum or being involved if there was, for example, a ballot initiative or a proposal to the board?
If there's a ballot initiative, we would be precluded from by law from having
it. From taking a position on it.
But it spells out what we can do is explain the factual process of what it does.
I'm even thinking, can we convene a presentation by people from who think about campaign finance or from other cities, or just an overview kind of thing within which the local debate about the merits of particular proposals can take place, or people who worked on originally putting it forward, people editorializing about it, people studying it, or even lending our name if someone else does it, because it's very possible that the idea that others will have the idea, but could we? It might be worth knowing whether we're able to co-sponsor a nonpartisan, not advocacy program that just said we are among those thinking about campaign finance, whether and how in our community. If the McCarthy Center or pick your favorite enterprise.
It would depend on, for example, what the level of participation by the commissioners were. So if you wanted to have like a panel discussion that the commission was part of, it would have to be a regularly scheduled, agendized meeting. Not by regular, I don't mean a regular monthly meeting, or a special meeting, but you would have to have a public agenda published in advance. If
all of us were going to be on it, or if a majority of us were going to be on it. Oh, I don't know. Yeah.
You could have other people there, but you would still need to have an agenda. You would need to have public comment.
I mean, that could be one model. I was imagining,
if we sponsored something where it was a public event and there were some commissioners and some other people presenting, but not a majority of the commission, then we would likely not have to go through those agenda requirements.
I guess the question is there any, what are the constraints, and is there any interest?
In addition to those,
to think about it.
I think you're absolutely right about those constraints. I would just say you really want to see whether there's a ballot measure proposed and what it says, and what the topic is.
Mm-hmm.
And we would work with you about what is possible at that point.
Right.
I have a hard time saying it in a vacuum.
It's not our role at all, and they don't want to do it at all. When we talked about it, there wasn't an immediate ballot measure, and so in a way, I think we thought we were getting out ahead of let's have a thoughtful, broad, measured, reasoned conversation, and then people will see what goes on the ballot. I didn't put it together with the timing requirements.
And other than those that the executive director mentions, I don't think there are constraints on what you can do if there's no ballot measure. and there may or may not be a ballot measure of any stripe, and we won't really know that until late February.
We just have to figure out who the co-sponsors would be, preferably somebody with an auditorium or money to rent one.
You mean co-sponsors not of the ballot initiative, but of such a program?
Of such a program.
Right, yeah. Yep.
So your thought is to have speakers come and
certain,
like others would present and mm-hmm. talk about certain issues. And
yes, I wasn't picturing it as all four or by then five of us. Maybe there is somebody from here who'd like to be on it, but it was more the idea of having people who could provide that kind of perspective.
I mean, the whole commission could go, but only one or two of you could like be a panelist, as long as it's a widely attended mm-hmm. public event.
And so so if there's no ballot initiative, but there's a proposal to the board, we can still, there's no restrictions about talking about that, or
there's legislation pending at the board, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Good. I think it's a good idea that we should explore.
Public
comment? There may not be a moment, but
right.
We can see.
Yeah. Public comment?
David Pilpel, just to comment very briefly on that idea. Even if current members of the commission are appropriately prohibited from discussing it, that might be an opportunity to invite former members of the commission who have a variety of different viewpoints, some of whom agree with current staff and commission direction, others who don't, and just to hear sort of some of their thoughts on current events. They certainly all, I think it's accurate to say, have spent their time considering all these issues at that point in time, and might well have some, you know, wise views to share, whether we agree with all of them or not. But there's some value to former commissioners here as well, and they are not similarly constrained as you are in this way. Something to think about.
Thank you.
Not all of them would I necessarily want to hear. In any event, it's something to think about. Thanks.
Public comment on matters appearing.
And happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you. And not appearing on the agenda. Seeing none, is there a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none. Happy holidays. Happy New Year.
Happy holidays, everybody. Yeah.